Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Thank you for being here. You're great. I come from Detroit and done politics for 20 years. And in Detroit, everything is black and white. Everything politically goes through the prism of race. The three of the four people in your book who I'm familiar with, I'm not as familiar with the guy from Alabama, seem to have rejected the identity politics of the previous generation, and they've succeeded. And there was a sense among many that that was sort of the death knell of the identity politics of an Al Sharpton or whatever. You know, a couple of weeks ago, Bobby Rush, as you alluded to, got up and played identity politics, you know, and it appears to have worked. What's your sense of the future of that generation of leadership, not just from an age passing the torch, but of the tactics of, you know, building on, you know, things that are always framed in the context of race?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the Bobby Rush situation again, because that, you know, ran counter to my entire thesis.
Me too.
But it also was a sobering reminder about how far we haven't come and how you can completely freeze the conversation still by invoking race if you want to. I don't think it's a particularly honorable way of doing it. I also don't think it's a forward-looking way of doing it. But it worked, and the people it worked on especially were the old white guys in the U.S. Senate who were most freaked. What? What? You're calling me a racist? No. Let's come right this way, Mr. Burris. But I think it's going to work less and less, because it depends on who rises to power. If the next generation of white leadership turns out to be people who are as forward-thinking and interested in coalition building as some of the people I profile in this book, I think you're going to see more of that. I mean, this goes deep. This goes to people like the mayor of Philadelphia, who endorsed Hillary Clinton and basically didn't really get a lot of grief for it, because the people in his city said, hey, listen, just figure this out for me. On the other hand, some of those same people, when he was running against a preferred black and then white candidate for mayor, looked at him and said, aren't you kind of an elitist? And he didn't know what that meant. Well, he knew what it meant. So even the folks who are breaking through are struggling with the tactics and trying to take a few steps forward before they get knocked several steps back. I caution against us thinking that this is the great transformation. It's a continuum, and we have to go over a pretty shallow curve before we get to where we might end up. But it's a challenge to me to figure out where we're going to end up, and I don't know yet. Someone, Al Sharpton actually said to me, you know, this isn't a big deal, this breakthrough stuff, because I've seen this before. I've been to this party before. Well, his point was there had been a whole generation of black mayors who came of age with great hopes in the 1960s and 70s, and that many of them just faded and fizzed out and, in fact, were replaced by white candidates right after. Some of them arrested, actually. But his point was this is nothing new. I think what he was missing is that these folks didn't come to power because someone carved something out for them. They came to power not because there was a machine that was created to get them elected and support them. They came to power more actually in the Harold Washington model, which is how do I reach beyond where my traditional base is. And because of that, they have something stronger to fall back on. The Al Sharptons of the world, by the way, believe themselves to be continually relevant because, well, first of all, he played this very well. He quietly talked to Obama but stayed out of the spotlight and did it on purpose because he knew it would hurt. He also believes that he continues to exist as a valuable agitator from the outside. And I don't have any problem with there being an agitator from the outside. Someone's got to hold someone's feet to the fire. I don't trust any one person to know what's best for everybody at all the time. But there was a funny moment that got overlooked largely this campaign on Saturday Night Live. It was one of those Robert Smigel cartoons, one of those animated sketches, and it was about Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. And it had the cartoon characters of Jackson and Sharpton attempting to get into Obama events. Sharpton was fitted with a collar that would shock him every time he arrived at the gate. And whenever Jackson showed up, the Michelle character would throw open someone's shoes to distract. And then Jackson would be taken into a closet by Obama, who would say, "I'm going to make you my ambassador to Lower Zumbutu." And it would take weeks before Jackson realized there was no such place. It was hilarious, but it showed definitely how he had managed to stiff-arm these guys without alienating them and minimize any damage they may have caused.
Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, December 9th, 2016. So I have been told this is our book study session, our debut session on Gwen Ifill. Her book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. The audio segment that you heard at the beginning of the program, that was Ms. Ifill, a talk that she gave in 2009 in California. She was talking, I think it was a white person who asked the question, talking about growing up in Detroit and black people, you know, allegedly being about identity politics and being able to mooch and maybe get things they don't deserve on the basis of being classified as a Negro. Maybe kind of what it sounded like to me and the whole exchange. But at any rate, the reason we are reading The Breakthrough at this moment, Gwen Ifill, award-winning journalist, news anchor at PBS News, she passed away at the age of 61 last month, November of 2016. We have been talking about this, even some of the racism she experienced as a black journalist, being attacked by Don Imus, race soldier, and white talk radio host, but I thought it would be great. I think really any time that you have a black person who devotes their time, expertise, skill to the problem of racism, and they have words or analysis of this problem, minimum we could do is maybe take a little bit of time to review. And I think particularly with this book was published in January 2009. It was published in between when President Obama won the 2008 election and when he was inaugurated in January of 2009. In fact, the audio that you heard at the beginning, that was days after he was inaugurated when she was giving that talk in California. So it's a fascinating moment, right, to capture what people were saying or what thoughts were prevalent, what ideas were being promoted around that time period. I think it is especially fascinating at this moment to be at that same point 8 years later, transitioning out of the Obama era into the Trump administration. I mean, wow, it is going to be, I think it'll be an amazing opportunity to just kind of to read and reflect and see, you know, did it sound like there was a notion of what could be on the horizon or, you know, the assessment? What is our assessment of the past 8 years of Obama in the White House now? I think it'll be a great opportunity for us to put our counter-racist thinking caps on, do some critical analysis and reflection, and I think Gwen Ifill would appreciate that. So I'm looking forward, without further ado, we will get started. This is The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one.
Highbridge Audio presents The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama by Gwen Ifill, read for you by the author.
Introduction. I learned how to cover race riots by telephone. They didn't pay me enough at my first newspaper job to venture onto the grounds of South Boston High School when bricks were being thrown. Instead, I would telephone the headmaster and ask him to relay to me the number of broken chairs in the cafeteria each day. A white colleague, dispatched to the scene, would fill in the details for me. I've spent 30 years in journalism since then, chronicling stories just like that, places where truth and consequences collide, rub up against each other, and shift history's course. None of that prepared me for 2008 and the astonishing rise of Barack Obama. It's true that he accomplished what no black man had before, but it went further than that. Simply as an exercise in efficient politics, Obama 08 rewrote the textbook. His accomplishment was historic and one that transformed how race and politics intersect in our society. Obama is the leading edge of this change, but his success is merely the ripple in a pond that grows deeper every day. When people do something that they've never done before, I think that makes it easier to do it a second time, David Axelrod, the Obama campaign's chief strategist, told me just days after Obama won. So when people vote for an African-American candidate, he said, I think it makes it easier for the next African-American candidate. The next African-American candidates, and a fair share of those already in office, subscribe to a formula driven as much by demographics as by destiny. When population shifts occur, brought about by fair housing laws, affirmative action, and landmark school desegregation rulings, political power is challenged as well. It happened in Boston, New York, Chicago, and every other big city reshaped by an influx of European immigration. It is happening again now in Miami and Los Angeles, in suburban Virginia and rural North Carolina, where the political calculus is being reshaped by Latino immigrants, with African Americans freighted with a legacy of slavery and the pushback from whites who refuse to feel guilty for the sins of their ancestors. The shift has been more scattered and sporadic, yet no less profound. When I began my journalism career at the Boston Herald American in 1977, Boston was awash in the sort of racial drama that foreshadows dramatic change. While I was attending Simmons College, the federal courts demanded that the city's very political school committee fix the city's racially unbalanced education system. The solution, imposed by U.S. District Court Judge W. Arthur Garrity in 1974, seemed pretty straightforward. Send white children to schools in black neighborhoods and black children to schools in white neighborhoods. It came to be known as forced busing. The idea was to impose balance where it no longer existed. The optimistic reasoning was that the resources, teachers, textbooks, shared experience, would follow. But history now shows us that busing, moving 20,000 students to and fro in search of a quality education, was, in fact, a far more radical notion than originally envisioned. It struck at the heart of neighborhood and racial identity in cities all over the nation, most memorably so in Irish South Boston and Black Roxbury. White residents of insular neighborhoods railed, sometimes violently, against the incursion into their neighborhood schools. Black residents in Roxbury railed right back. As I walked to my college classes in Boston's Fenway neighborhood that fall, I saw the result with my own eyes. Boston's finest, in riot gear, stepping in to prevent clashes at English High School. It was a scene that played out again and again all over the city, all over the country. The white kids don't like black kids, and the black kids don't like white kids, a white student said after one of the melees I covered by phone. All of it is prejudice, the student said. All I know is that no one's getting any education. It's a perfect example that forced desegregation and forced busing does not work, Elvira Pixie Palladino, an anti-busing member of the school committee, told me at the time. White students fled the city schools during those years, so many that the majority white city's education system became majority black within a decade. By 2000, only a quarter of the city's children were white, and white children accounted for under 14% of enrollments in the city's elementary schools. It took some years and a more sophisticated understanding of how race and poverty intersect for me to begin to understand that what I saw in Boston was about more than just black and white kids not liking each other. It was the beginning of a power shift that was defined by, but not limited to, race. I moved to Baltimore in 1981, where the tipping point I had witnessed taking shape in Boston was a little further along. When I arrived, the city's leaders were still mostly white, but 56% of the city's residents were already non-white, a number that grew to 64% by 2000. On the surface, Baltimore's political vibe was less charged than Boston's, but the power shifts were no less significant. The city's paternalistic mayor, William Donald Schaefer, had revived downtown with a national aquarium and a Disney-like harbor development that brought tourists in droves. Twin baseball and football stadiums were poised to sprout on downtown's southern edge. Gleaming condominiums and hotels replaced what had been run-down waterfront docks. Schaefer was hailed in national magazines as an urban savior. Howard Cosell told a Monday night football audience that Schaefer was the genius mayor. But not far from the glittering downtown development most convention visitors saw, the picture was more complicated. Crime was climbing, the schools were sliding, and change was in the offing. Schaefer, an unmarried curmudgeon used to getting his own way, was suspicious of change, and he was doubly suspicious of any call for change that seemed rooted in racial claims. That meant that he would also be suspicious of me, a black woman whose job it was to ask him questions he didn't like. As he growled and snapped at me, and honestly at most other reporters too, I came to realize what I was witnessing, the friction that is a necessary byproduct of sandpaper change. In 1983, Billy Murphy, a black judge and scion of a prominent local family, decided to use the sandpaper. Schaefer was still immensely popular, but he was also aware that new minority majorities had recently swept black mayors into office for the first time in cities such as Atlanta, and that the barrier was about to fall that year in Philadelphia as well. In the end, Murphy turned out to be a pretty inadequate Democratic primary candidate, disorganized and unfocused. Even though Andrew Young, then mayor of Atlanta, Martin Luther King III, and comedian and activist Dick Gregory came to town to campaign for Murphy, Schaefer still managed to snare fully half of the black vote in a majority black city. In defeat, though, Murphy's challenge was enough to open some eyes to the possibility that the mayor for life, as Schaefer had been dubbed, might be displaced. Perhaps it was time for a candidate who looked like most of the people who lived in the city. Schaefer hated this line of reasoning, openly detested Murphy, and refused to speak his name aloud. Still, he saw the handwriting on the wall. 4 years later, Baltimore did get its black mayor when, after 16 years in charge, Schaefer was elected governor and selected a successor to fill his unexpired term. Clarence Dew Burns, the affable city council president who had risen to that position from humble beginnings as a locker room attendant, was only too happy to claim a job he might never have been able to win outright. "I got standing ovations at churches," Burns marveled years later. "I hadn't done anything for them, but I was the first black mayor, you understand?" Burns, who learned the ways of city politics behind every closed door at City Hall, ended up spending 17 years there, but only 11 months as mayor. The first time he ran for the job outright, Burns was defeated by a younger, politically unanointed Yale and Harvard-educated attorney, a black man with the unlikely name of Kurt Schmoke. Schmoke had abandoned a prestigious post in the Carter White House to return home to Baltimore. "I thought, why did he give up working in the White House?" said his former White House colleague, Christopher Edley Jr. "What's going on?" And he said, "I'm going to indict a few bad guys, make some connections in the corporate world, and run for office." That is exactly what Schmoke did, first winning election as state's attorney before making the run for City Hall. Even though he was up against a well-oiled Schaefer machine, Schmoke defeated Burns by 5,000 votes, by capturing the imagination of Baltimore voters, black and white, in a way that neither Murphy nor Burns, with their old-school ties and backroom ways, could. I was kind of the beneficiary, in a way, of a change sparked by the latter end of the civil rights movement, said Schmoke, who is now the dean of the Howard University School of Law, which produced Thurgood Marshall, L. Douglas Wilder, and Vernon Jordan. The Voting Rights Act, which opened up so many opportunities throughout the country, he said, started to hit its stride by 1980, and people built on that. That trend was also in evidence about 40 minutes down the interstate highway in Prince George's County, Maryland. By 1984, I had taken my unintentional road trip through sandpaper politics to this Washington suburb, where between 1980 and 1990, the African-American population spurted from 37% to 50%. During that same period, nearly 77,000 whites moved elsewhere, a loss of nearly 20% of the county's white population. The county's power structure was in the midst of a corresponding shift from mostly white to mostly black when I was covering it for the Washington Post. As occurred with Schmoke in Baltimore, the resulting friction provided for a memorable foreshadowing of what was to be revealed later on the national stage. Wayne Curry was Prince George's County's version of Kurt Schmoke, but with a little backroom dealing experience thrown in for good measure. Smooth and politically astute, he learned early on to navigate the shoals of the backwater politics that had defined this collection of poor and middle-class black and white suburbs and tobacco-growing rural communities. Middle-class blacks were thronging to Prince George's, replacing farmland with cul-de-sacs and even gated golf course communities. Between 1979 and 1989, the county's median household income, once adjusted for inflation, rose by 15%. As a result, PG, as it was still derisively called by people who did not live there, had become the home of the most prosperous population of African Americans in the nation. By 2005, 66% of the county was black. Curry, who made his mark as a real estate development lawyer, parlayed his business connections into two terms as county executive from 1994 to 2002. Over the years, he managed to establish close ties to both the existing white political establishment and the emerging black one. In his salad days, Curry was considered a rabble-rouser, a smooth talker who could speak the language of the moneyed developers and old-time Pauls who were together plotting the county's future. In short, he was the kind of guy who made white and black people nervous. 58 years old and watching from the sidelines those following in his footsteps, Curry has mixed feelings about the generation of black politicians now rising. "I don't automatically see it as a good thing," he told me. "I think it could be a very, very discouraging moment, in fact, if once guys get in those positions, they don't have an idea or a theory about who to help or why, just to become figureheads that aren't doing much of anything to make it better for people across the board." Elected as a Hillary Clinton delegate to the 2008 Democratic National Convention, Curry endorsed Obama only after Clinton dropped out in June. Curry's concerns echo throughout any discussion of black politics today. What is the point of electing African Americans to high office if their ties to the black community do not bind them tightly enough to black causes? Is a black candidate who, for instance, opposes affirmative action a breakthrough worth having? Or, as Georgetown sociology professor Michael Eric Dyson put it to me, if this is the price we pay for that kind of access, we'd rather not have it. By the time the Post assigned me to cover the Reverend Jesse Jackson's second presidential race in 1988, I had grown familiar with variations on this argument, which usually cropped up whenever a new black face intruded on a previously all-white and sometimes all-black political landscape. The toughest tests often played out from within the black community itself, where in most cases, political achievement and the conflict that came with it were only a generation old. In 1984, Jackson ran for president, doubled the number of black voters casting ballots in that year's New York primary, and startled the political world with his powerful "I am somebody" imagery and his unabashedly racial appeals. It did not bother him one bit to use the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. as part of that imagery, in part because he had been a witness to it. On April 4, 1968, there was a crucifixion in Memphis, he would say while campaigning. In New York this week, we began to roll the stone away. The crucifixion of April 1968 will become the resurrection of April 1984. Jackson scared people, and he was perfectly aware of it. The headline in that week's Time magazine reflected the nervous political zeitgeist of the moment. "What does Jesse really want?" it read. Jackson's 1988 run was different from his more quixotic 1984 candidacy. By then, white faces had joined the black faces on the Jackson bandwagon. His campaign manager, Gerald Austin, was white, and some of his most influential supporters, including Democratic operative Harold Ickes and Ann Lewis, would go on 4 years later to help get Bill Clinton elected. Jackson had worked energetically to reach beyond his black church base to establish himself as a force to be reckoned with. "My friend Gary is out of the race," he told a crowd at a predominantly Hispanic Denver Roman Catholic parish where former Senator Gary Hart sat in the front pew. "That makes me Colorado's favorite son." Jackson's ability to enlarge his base continued to rattle the political establishment. He emerged the victor of the 1988 Michigan primary. This time, the Time magazine cover line shrieked, "Jesse," with an exclamation point and a question mark. Writers began to speculate that he would sweep Lily White, Wisconsin, too. I interviewed the mayor of Sheboygan, Wisconsin during that period. Upon meeting me, he anxiously pointed out the framed pictures he had on his wall of boxers and other athletes to prove that some of his best friends were black. I was surprised only that he actually said this to my face, and the exchange convinced me that maybe this was not Jackson country. The following week, Michael Dukakis trounced Jackson in the Democratic primary, not only in Sheboygan, but in all the rest of Wisconsin as well. Still, there was something happening here. Jackson's supporters were made up of far more than the traditional civil rights constituency. They were, in fact, the left-wing version of the very same people who flocked to rallies that same year for another man of the cloth, Pat Robertson. Everywhere he went, Jackson preached a now familiar sermon, the power of hope. Obama would appropriate that powerful theme decades later. Jackson's effort eventually crumbled amid intra-party acrimony, but by the time the August convention rolled around, he had won in more than a dozen contests, and there were a breathless few months where much seemed possible. That spring, Jackson frequently told a story on the stump about a white man who had approached him in Beaumont, Texas, to tell him that he too had attended the famous Selma to Montgomery Civil Rights March in Alabama in 1965, but the man told Jackson he'd been there with the Ku Klux Klan. Time had passed, priorities had changed, and now the man said he was supporting Jackson. "Even extremes learn to come together to survive," Jackson preached. The more possible the nomination seemed, the more Jackson attempted to broaden his appeal. He kissed a lot of white babies for photographers that spring and suddenly started eschewing talk of storming the gates in favor of more mainstream rhetoric. "I don't understand boundless liberalism," he told the Women's Economic Club of Detroit. "Neither do I understand static conservatism. We opened up an exclusive club and turned the mainstream into a flowing river," he told me at the time. "By broadening the stream, my views are now in the center." These voters felt disenfranchised. Their conviction that no one was listening or speaking to them was about more than race. It was about shared grievance, too. Even before Michael S. Dukakis captured the Democratic nomination, Willie Brown, the canny San Francisco mayor, who served as Jackson's national campaign chairman, correctly began calling the campaign the Jackson Movement. The political part of the movement stuttered to a halt after Dukakis refused to pick Jackson as his running mate. But as the Democrats prepared to convene in Atlanta to nominate their ticket, the resourceful Chicago preacher did not immediately leave the stage. He took his entourage by bus from Illinois to Georgia. Along the way, the vanquished candidate stopped at a rally at Jefferson Street Baptist Church in Nashville, where he spoke in front of a large banner strung behind the pulpit. "Jesse, you're a winner," it read. But even that would not work out as planned. As Jackson spoke, the banner behind his head began to sag and peel. Organizers struggled to right the banner, then remove it, but as it fell, Its weight ripped a second banner almost in half. That one read, "Where do we go from here?" Still, Jackson managed a breakthrough of sorts, one that went beyond politics. Everywhere, the terrain was changing. Black politicians were going mainstream. 20 years later, network cameras would capture Jackson standing in Chicago's Grant Park, tears streaming down his face, as Obama walked on stage to accept the presidency. In 1990, L. Douglas Wilder, a Korean War veteran who was raised in Richmond, Virginia, and attended that city's segregated schools, was elected the Commonwealth's 66th governor and the nation's first African-American state leader ever. But he won the election by a lead far narrower than pre-election polls had predicted. This came to be known as the Bradley effect, after former Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley, an African-American who lost the 1982 race for California governor to a white man, George Dukmejian, even though polls had shown him winning by as much as 22 points. "People lied," Wilder told me years later, but months before Obama would be elected. "And they will continue to lie," he said. "Racism is never going to go away, and we shouldn't convince ourselves that it could." There has, however, been considerable debate about the Bradley effect. One Dukmejian pollster said the conclusion was based entirely on the speculation of respected California pollster Mervyn Field, who had no other way to explain why his pre-election polling was off the mark. The Bradley effect was born amidst some major polling errors and a confusing array of mixed predictions, hardly a firm foundation to construct a theory, pollster V. Lance Terrence Jr. wrote 26 years later. Obama himself called the theory outdated and overstated. In fact, the question of how voters behaved in secret when faced with a racial choice increasingly cut the opposite way. In the 2006 midterm elections, African Americans lost 4 out of 5 statewide races, but in those cases, their losses were foreshadowed accurately in pre-election polling. Harold Ford Jr., who ran and lost a race for U.S. Senate, actually drew more votes overall, not just white votes, on election day than the last polls had predicted he would. Obama continued that trend. Exit polls showed not only that he outperformed 2004 nominee John Kerry among white voters, but also that those who made up their minds within the last few days, theoretically the secret lying racists of the Bradley effect, voted for him as well. R.I.P. the Bradley effect. Once again, Obama became the most famous example of a trend that was already taking hold largely out of the public eye. Other African Americans have also successfully attracted white support over the years, many of them in local and state government. In 1996, environmentalist and county council member Ron Sims, who marched in civil rights protests with his parents while he was growing up in Spokane, Washington, was appointed to the top executive's job in Seattle's overwhelmingly white King County and has since been reelected twice. By 2007, there were 622 black state legislators, 30% of them from predominantly white districts. In 2001, only about 16% of the black legislators represented majority white areas. The evolution that has brought us to our latest sandpaper crossroads has been as much generational as racial. Black mayors have been elected with significant white support in Cincinnati, Ohio, Buffalo, New York, and even Iowa City, part of a wave of more than 40 African Americans now running American cities. Barack Obama's historic 2008 presidential campaign touched on all the themes I've covered throughout my career and all of the layers of meaning that run through black politics. Ambition, aspiration, fear, folly, all were on display as Obama boarded the roller coaster that ultimately led to the White House. And as he took on the ultimate political challenge, America's conflicts about race were laid bare again and again. Edward W. Brooke, who was elected Massachusetts Attorney General in 1962 and 4 years later became the nation's first post-Reconstruction black U.S. senator, believes that if his state was ready 4 decades ago, the rest of the country might be now. "I would love to see a lot of things happen between now and the time I lay me down to rest," said Brooke, now retired and living in Florida, where he is encouraged by the rise of a new generation of black politicians. All I'm saying is that you can't win unless you run. You gotta have that fire in the belly, that desire to achieve, to win that position, and to do something with it when you do win. Obama sent Brooke a copy of one of his books inscribed, "Thank You for Paving the Way." Brooke responded with a signed copy of his own autobiography in which he called Obama a worthy bearer of the torch. But the passing of the torch has been fraught with all of the insecurities and rivalries that can be brought on by consequential change. Hovering over every conflict for these breakthrough candidates has always been the question of race. A career spent watching politicians of every gender, color, and creed trying to sort their way through the abrasions of political change has taught me much. I witnessed the uneasy transition from the civil rights struggle to direct engagement in electoral politics. As Black politicians have broken through, I've documented the friction that has resulted when new realities, demographic as well as political, confront established customs and institutions. So it should have come as no surprise to me when I was briefly caught up in the crosswinds of the very conflict I'd spent the years documenting. But it did. Barely 24 hours before I was to moderate the season's only vice presidential debate in 2008, John McCain supporters decided to stir the pot, and they imagined throw me off balance by suggesting that they had just discovered that this book was to be a piece of pro-Obama puffery. It was easy enough to discover that this was not true. The book and its true topic had been hiding in plain sight for more than a year, as I interviewed dozens of subjects and wrote on the topic for more than one national magazine. But I was a hard target to resist. An African-American journalist writing about race could not possibly be capable of thinking bigger thoughts, could she? In retrospect, this was a small distraction that blew over the second the debate ended. And I quickly came to realize that my brush with sandpaper politics was a mere scratch compared to the struggles of African-American politicians who had been fighting to establish a political beachhead for decades before I, or Barack Obama for that matter, ever came along. The difference now is that in the 21st century, the breakthrough generation of Black politicians is aiming to capture much bigger territory. Obama's relentless and disciplined giant-slaying campaign is by no means the only story. This audio program will tell the rest. Chapter 1, Breaking Through. So the first generation comes through and they say, great, you get your law degree and you go out and you be a troublemaker in the Black community. Second wave comes through and aha, now I've got opportunities in business. Third wave comes through, and maybe we've gotten to the point where we can get somewhere with mainstream politics, not protest politics. It becomes a viable choice in ways that it might not have, in more places than it might have been. Christopher Edley, Jr. It is easy to overlook change when it happens, even when it is as dramatic and historic as this year's breakthrough presidential election. But as I stood at Denver's Invesco Field on the night Barack Obama accepted his party's nomination for president, I swear I could feel the rumbling under my feet. The Reverend Jesse Jackson strode through the crowd, remembering how different this night was from the day 24 years before when he'd had his own star turn at a Democratic National Convention. "I'm excited beyond measure," he told me. His son, Illinois Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., held court at a purposeful distance from his father. Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, and Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, grinned and backslapped and owned the night as the rising stars they are. Artur Davis, the Alabama congressman with designs on the governor's office, sorted through a crowded dance card of public appearances. Benjamin Jealous, newly elected to lead the venerable NAACP, choked up. He was 35 years old. Each in his own way was basking in the political glow of the night. They were not interlopers or token Black invitees at this particular party. They did not necessarily even know each other particularly well, but they were the stars of the evening. For one night, all of the friction and below-the-radar political positioning each had endured, much of it obscured by Obama's meteoric rise, was on display. It was a rare lightning-stroke moment that finally illuminated the dramatic shift in tone, message, and leadership that has forced a redefinition of Black politics and of black politicians. It was the age of Obama in full effect. On television, that sparkling night in Denver appeared to be all about a presidential nomination. But in the stadium itself, it was about so much more. It was about the past, about progress, and about race, the most divisive issue in the nation's history. And it provided a convenient yardstick with which to measure what the change Obama talked so much about could really mean. Before my eyes, I was able to witness the romance and achievement of 1960s civil rights marches bearing fruit as the lions of the movement mingled with the up-and-comers. Some had been slow to embrace Barack Obama, some had been quick, but this night all wanted to bear witness. The 2008 election forced Americans unused to talking about race to confront their own biases or their own naivete. Civil rights heroes had to learn to relate to a generation of excited new voters, black, white, and brown, who had not yet been born when they scored their last legislative victories. Newcomers pondered how to push their elders off the stage without being disrespectful. It was a sandpaper moment for everyone, as Americans struggled with the kind of friction that forces self-examination, conflict, and finally, actual change. There were many ways to measure this race-based change. In 1958, more than half of Americans responding to a Gallup poll said they would not vote for a black candidate. By 1984, the number had dropped to 16%. By 2007, only 4% told Newsweek they would not. In 2008, 43% of white Americans cast their votes for Obama. That sounds unimpressive until you notice that John Kerry, a white candidate, got only 41% of the white vote in 2004. The nation had moved a long way, even from the 1970s, where the prospect of black mayors taking over from white mayors spawned slogans like, "Atlanta's too young to die," and in Los Angeles, "Will your city be safe with this man?" Obama's unexpected breakthrough made it blazingly clear that we had reached a place we had not been before. John Lewis, the Georgia congressman who was 23 years old when he appeared on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial with Martin Luther King Jr. at the 1963 March on Washington, said 2008 was unlike anything he had ever experienced. "I think it's something new. It's different. It's exciting," said Lewis, who had his own breakthrough when he was elected to Congress in 1986 at the age of 46. "It is almost like the dreams, the hopes, the aspirations are being realized." To be clear right off the bat, I do not believe this to be a post-racial moment, as so many have claimed. After talking to scores of people for this book, I'm still not even entirely sure what that term means. My well-reported suspicion is that it is the type of code language that conveniently means different things to different people. For those interested in resisting any discussion of racial difference, it's an easy way to embrace the mythic notion of colorblindness. For civil rights veterans, it is a term that sparks outrage. Why is getting past race considered to be a good thing? Does that make race a bad thing? For some up-and-coming politicians hoping to build their success on erasing rather than maintaining lines of difference, the idea has some appeal. Those are the fault lines. Can insiders affect real change, or do they become change's worst enemy once they're inside? This is when the friction kicks in, that sandpaper place where change happens and the nerve endings of ambition become exposed and frayed. Sometimes sparks fly, and often, for a while at least, it is difficult to discern the good. The protest marchers find themselves picketing black elected officials. The officials, so recently inside the door, find it necessary to push back. In politics, this usually signals that a painful and challenging power shift is underway, and seldom are all of the parties involved happy about it. This is what happens with a breakthrough. The first ones through the door often get bruised, if not broken. Eventually, with a little political acumen and racial sensitivity and a lot of hard work, a smooth new place can emerge. There has never been a change in the condition of blacks that has been as dramatic and consequential as the change from the time I was born to now, Roger Wilkins, a 76-year-old historian, journalist, and veteran activist, told me. "Never, never," he said. And as the country changes, as the opportunity structure for Black people changes, we're going to get different leaders. The breakthrough has not occurred overnight, although it sometimes seems as if it did. There were critical moments along the way. In 2006, 5 Black men ran for governor or U.S. Senate in Ohio, Maryland, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts. 3 were Republicans. That was a breakthrough. In the end, however, only one, Deval Patrick, won. But how quickly things shifted. When the Massachusetts governor went to Boston Common 2 years later to endorse Obama, 10,000 people gathered to cheer the 2 Black men who stood hands clasped on the same bandstand used by segregationist George Wallace as he campaigned for president in 1968. That was another breakthrough. Similar signs of racial progress have been popping up everywhere, and many optimistic Americans seem ready to embrace it. In mid-2007, 71% of all voters assessed relations between Blacks and whites as very or somewhat good. The pessimists, interestingly enough, were African Americans. Only 55% were willing to offer a similarly positive response. Americans have come a great distance, as the 2008 election results and the multiracial euphoria that followed demonstrated. But when it comes to any issue, debate, or ambition shaded by race, we have not yet come to a common place. Discussions are coded, and politicians often stumble unaware into definitional chasms. How was Delaware Senator Joe Biden to know the uproar he would ignite when he called Obama clean and articulate? And should Bill Clinton, famous for being simpatico with African Americans, have realized that referring to Obama's record as a fairy tale or comparing his electoral victories to Jesse Jackson's would sound racially dismissive? John McCain stumbled into the same minefield when he caustically referred to Obama as that one during a presidential debate. Whites I talked to considered it dismissive but not insulting. Blacks I talked to were outraged. It can be consequential when intention diverges so sharply from meaning and race is involved. Throughout our nation's history, the most eventful change has often been driven by racial conflict. Wars have been fought, marches have been led, and movements have been nurtured from the pain and discovery of our evolving debate over the politics of difference. Segregation made us all alike. It made us think alike, Julian Bond told me over coffee in a Washington, D.C. bakery where, integration aside, we were the only Black customers. We lived together. We read the same newspapers, he said, our own newspapers. So we had a group consciousness that has been dissipated to some degree by the demise of segregation. So we are a different kind of people now than we would have been, say, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And it has its upsides and it has its downsides. Many of us, no matter what race, are content to remain perched on the sidelines of our great political debates. For the better part of the 1990s, most Americans, and certainly the news media, appeared more preoccupied with televised murder trials and helicopter chases than with elections and voting. We seemed capable of being roused from our spectator's pose only when something truly spectacular was at stake: war, terror, global economic crises that threatened our 401ks. Obama's 2008 run proved an exception to this trend. While overall voter turnout remained roughly the same from 2004, more Democrats, propelled by the Obama candidacy, did go to the polls. It was the Republicans who stayed home. Politics affects every decision we make, as well as every decision taken out of our hands. It defines our past and dictates our future. When politics intersects with our lives, history books must be rewritten. This has been especially true for African Americans making their way in the United States, seizing first equality and then power in fits and starts. Abolitionist Frederick Douglass was correct in 1857 when he said, "Power concedes nothing without a demand." As the demands have grown more urgent, the history of Blacks in politics has always been inextricably linked to the progress of the civil rights movement. Rosa Parks did not just happened to be on that bus in Montgomery. She signed up for civil rights training first. Fannie Lou Hamer did not just happen to integrate Mississippi's unseated delegation to the 1964 Democratic National Convention. She began trying to register to vote in 1962. And Martin Luther King Jr. did not limit his agitations to marches and pulpits. Civil rights historians have chronicled how exhaustively he also pulled the levers of politics and power to maneuver the passage of civil and voting rights legislation. Demand, some of it overt, some of it leavened with political nuance, has long been the key to Black political advancement in America. Now that this demand has forced laws onto the books and Black politicians have been elected, what has become of that movement? Who has inherited the King legacy? And as the 1960s leaders age and fade, a new generation is asking a different question. Does this century even require another King, a single leader? Tony West, a 42-year-old African-American lawyer in San Francisco who raised money and knocked on doors for Obama in 2008, is the picture of upper-middle-class success in his downtown high-rise office. Pictures of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., and Michael Dukakis, the former Massachusetts governor who gave him his first job in politics, line the walls. He is enough of a political junkie that he studied for the bar exam while on the Democratic National Convention floor in 1992, and he worked the floor for Obama again in 2008. Activism, he said, has taken on a different tone from the days when an older generation had to risk violence and arrest to make a difference. He tried once to run for office on his own and got a taste of what happens when you step out of line. He was defeated resoundingly. The lesson I learned, he said, is how angry people get with you when you don't go through the traditional channels, when you don't wait your turn, when you don't kiss the ring, when you don't do all the things that you're supposed to do in order to get there. West says he learned how to take risks from his parents, who grew up, met, and were educated in the South. But his experience has been different. Their day-to-day life experience, he said, in dealing with discrimination, dealing with segregation, Jim Crow, is just something that at best I've read about or know the stories of as told to me. But it is not something that I have had to confront on a daily basis. Super lawyer Vernon Jordan has more in common with West's parents. He earned his civil rights bona fides running the Urban League and the United Negro College Fund. But he learned the ropes of the movement, chauffeuring NAACP pioneer Roy Wilkins to and from meetings in Georgia in the 1960s. He identifies five distinct brands of Black leadership: the grassroots activist, the corporate titan, the traditional civil rights organizer, the self-made entrepreneur, and the elected official. These leaders range from CEOs to hip-hop artists to mayors, and they do not necessarily represent a single worldview. When we went across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, he said, there was no guarantee we were all going to come out the same on the other side. He told me this over lunch, figuratively invoking the lessons of the 1965 Selma to Montgomery march. Clarence Thomas went across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, too, he said, but there was no guarantee we would all be alike, because there have always been divisions in the community.
Context of white supremacy. That is audio segment number one. If folks would like to participate, share your thoughts, questions, ideas, what you heard from the first half of the reading, Gwen Ifill's The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, feel free to dial in the number 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you want to chime in during the broadcast, you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinyty.cc/1race. And that is the number one. Address again, tinyty.cc/1race. And that is the number one. When you put in that address, look on the left of the page. You should see a link that says Free Vote Line. Click that link. It will open up a small window on your screen. Top line on that new window, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can use a nickname, real name. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us live, and it's the same procedure if you would like to participate. You will see the dial pad on your screen. Press *6, and you will hear an audio prompt. It will ask you to press the number one. Do so. I will see your hand on the switchboard, and we will get you on the line. Line on. So if folks have any comments they would like to share, let's see, people who dialed in who have a hand up. Lines should be open. The caller at 3637. You should be with us. Did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Yes, I did. Hello, Calvin Smith, and hello, Gus. I have some comments. Sorry if I'm out of breath. I had to run upstairs, close the door, and be in silence. I like Gwen Ifill. I just discovered Gwen Ifill. I didn't really know about her until I recently, probably 5 years ago, stopped using cable. And so I started watching more PBS and really interesting shows. And then that's how I came across her. But good journalist. And the notes that I have here are, I wrote down Pat Robinson. She said something about him in the intro. And let's see here. So somebody from Wisconsin, I think maybe it was one of the governors or mayors, was saying that they were showing a lot of pictures of him with different black people, athletes and everything. And then it was like he was saying, my best friends are black. And I guess he did actually say that, like, look, some of my best friends are black, and, you know, white people always, they like doing that, trying to be one with you, saying that, look, I have black friends too. And I also wrote down about civil rights. It was a person, a KKK person, that said that he was going to vote for Jesse Jackson, I believe, because the last time he was dealing with civil rights, he was a KKK person, but this time he's out the KKK, and he's going to go ahead and support what's going on with Jesse Jackson. And I noted that, and I just wanted to know, like, I wonder, did he ever switch back to KKK since he got away from it and went to Jesse Jackson? And I noted that Dukakis did not want Jesse Jackson as a running mate. And I said, wow, that's interesting. And I got Q Pope Alive. I remembered that from Jesse Jackson saying when he was running, the little bit that I was with. I mean, I was younger, but I was up on it a little bit. And then that made me think of Hope and Change that they had for Barack Obama, for President Barack Obama's saying. So that was kind of similar. I also noted that Bradley effect, and that what it meant. I heard of it, but I didn't know what it meant. So I was glad they gave us the meaning of it. And then I thought, I wonder, did that, because it said R.I.P. Brantley effect, but I wonder, was that kind of something that happened in this past election where people were thinking that it was going to be one person and it ended up being the other person? And I wrote down that she sat with Julian Bond, I think I remember Dr. Wilson saying something about, I think it was Julian Bond saying something about her hair. He didn't like it, that she had her natural hair. I believe it was. I could be wrong. But the discussion that they had, I couldn't figure out if he was for integration or he was against it. And that was interesting. I just jotted that down. Do we require a single leader? That was a question. That's a good question. I always ask that question. Does it have to be one person? Can it be, you know, independent, you know, compensatory, you know? So I always think of that. I wrote down the grassroots, the corporate, and the self-made entrepreneur. There was one more that I missed. I'll have to rewind it to see what that was. I wrote down, she mentioned Fannie Lou Hamer. That's one of my heroes right there. And she mentioned that the mistreatment hasn't been going on before her or Obama got into what they're doing, her in journalism, and I guess Obama in politics. And that just made me think of Negative Evers. And those are the notes that I took so far, and I'm very excited about reading this with you all, and thank you.
Going on. Thomas in New York, did you have commentary you wanted to share? Thomas in New York, did you have commentary?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Hey, good evening. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers. You know, my only commentary is I'm not a big fan of Slady. And just listening to the reading so far, this is why I'm not a big fan of her. Of you as part of the problem. And but some of the little tidbits she put in about the behind the scenes things, you know, are pretty interesting. And that's what I'm gonna listen for. But you know, I've never been a big fan of her. And I'm with my line, thank you.
You said something, it's been part of the problem. I just didn't understand the sentence.
I said, I view her as being part of the problem. Those showcase people they put on TV to talk like they're really part of America, to give the impression that, you know, black people's thoughts and concepts matter. Just, you know, being paraded in front of the TV. And I view all of the blacks that I see on the news pretty much similar. They're talking like this, oh, our country, like, you know, like they have say-so. I just feel like part of the problem is that when black people see those people, they also think like those people. And they're not going to be thinking about the system in an accurate way if they're engaged with this type of the concepts. I mean, I've watched her for years. She's a newscaster. I just hate when I see these people on TV talking like their opinion really matters. You know, if you're serious, I think what you do as a journalist is much more constructive, and it's the way it should be done. It's grassroots. It's for blacks. You know, you're not talking for blacks, for whites, if you get what I'm saying.
Appreciate the detail. Thank you. I didn't hear what the sentence was. I got the sentence, and then I got an explanation as well. Always good to get clarity. If other folks have observations, comments they would like to share, feel free. I am shortening the first audio segment. We do two audio segments from the book that we're reading each Friday. And I'm shortening the first one. It used to be about an hour, sometimes a little more, having it be a little closer to about 50 minutes now, somewhere between 50 and 45. So it'll start a little bit earlier than it normally would. Just be aware, not way earlier, but just a little bit earlier. Hopefully that will not cause too much of an issue. The person who dialed in, 5771, 5771, did you have observations, questions, comments?
Yeah, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Pretty interesting read so far. Gwen is a journalist, and you could just, you know, I'm listening to it. I don't have the book in front of me, but, you know, you could just tell, you know, it's very, you know, it reads like a, kind of like a newspaper article. So she doesn't take a lot of positions. You know, she just basically kind of reports, you know, some of the stuff that she's experienced. I'm glad she brought out the Jesse Jackson election, because I thought that was a big thing in political history. Kind of what Bernie Sanders kind of did this year, where he kind of shook up the elections, and Jesse, you know, did that, what, 30 years ago. So, thought that was pretty interesting. There was a politician that she mentioned, I guess his name was West. Can't remember his first name, but, she mentioned about something about when, in his apartment, he had a picture of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Michael Dukakis, which I didn't, I was like trying to see what the connection is there with that. It's almost like when black folks have like, you know, a picture of Martin Luther King and white Jesus and John F. Kennedy back in the old days. Also, too, it was interesting. I think she mentioned Clarence Thomas being part of the march from the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And that was pretty interesting, because, you know, it kind of shows you that, you know, maybe at one point Clarence Thomas was actually, you know, codified. You know, he probably didn't agree with a lot of the people that he marched with, but, you know, he marched anyway across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. So maybe later on in life he decided, you know, not to be codified anymore. But it's interesting that, you know, Clarence Thomas did have some sort of codification at some point in his life. So, I believe that's all I have for now. I'll mute my line.
Oh, right on, right on. The lawyer was Tony West, the black 40-something California attorney who had the photo of Michael Dukakis on his wall in addition to Malcolm X. I too thought that was a strange triplet. I was trying to make sense of that as well, but my brain could not make sense of it. Also, importantly, and this relates to a very important point, metaphors. Now, Gwen Ifill did not make the comment about Clarence Thomas going across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. She was quoting Vernon Jordan, black male victim of racism. He said, he's using going across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which is the bridge in Selma, Alabama, where John Lewis was nearly killed. They just had the anniversary last year. Ava DuVernay's film, Selma, Edmund Pettus, and the bridge itself, Edmund Pettus, which she had brought out, that bridge is named after a Klansman, one of the most infamous Klansmen in the early 20th century in that area of Alabama, and they deliberately named the bridge after him to let people know what this area of Alabama is all about. But that is Edmund Pettus. I didn't learn that until last year. Anywho, Mr. Jordan, he says, when we went across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, there was no guarantee we were all going to come out the same on the other side. And so that is a metaphor, right? And so then he comes back to that metaphor when he mentions Clarence Thomas a sentence later when he says Clarence Thomas went across the Edmund Pettus Bridge too. So Clarence Thomas was not actually in Selma marching, literally. This is a metaphor.
Oh, okay.
And this would be another example of why I say that we should be very careful with metaphors, because I found a lot of times metaphors and racism promote confusion. Sorry if I was long-winded in getting to just saying that Clarence Thomas didn't march in Selma, but both of those were equally important.
I'm sorry. I didn't know. My bad.
No apologies. That's hopefully we get accuracy, get things correct as we move along. No apologies needed, though. But that is a danger of metaphor. Sometimes people can be confused. Sometimes people can take things literally when they are not meant literally. But that was the metaphor that was being used. Let me check to see if we have other folks who have commentary. The person, not sure. Is that Roz? Did you have commentary?
Greetings, guys. This is Roz. My number looks straight.
Just got confused a little bit. had to do a lot.
It's all good. I hope you're having a decent Friday. I know normally you're doing right poorly like I am. So hopefully everything works itself out this evening for you. And greetings to you and the other callers. I didn't receive the book yet. I should have it by the next session. So I wasn't able to hear everything because my stomach's been bothering me. I'm working on that while I'm listening to the show. But I did want to say I do agree with some of the points that Thomas in New York made in regards to the blacks that are being showcased, and how just that whole process of using black people in that manner can help refine the system of white supremacy, because it will give the average black citizen the impression that things are changing or have changed in ways that they really haven't, which promotes further confusion. So I do agree with him in that assessment. There was one thing that I was able to catch, but I don't remember it fully. I'm a victim, so excuse me. But there was something she had said about segregation and how things had kind of, she alluded to how things had changed for the black community. I don't believe in that term, but I'll just put that in quotes. But things had changed after integration. And when she said that, she made me think of something that I heard my 88-year-old father-in-law say and Dr. Ben say many, many years ago. And that was that integration was the worst thing that happened to us. And I agree with that, simply because even though we are not and have never been a monolithic people, ultimately, when we were segregated, we understood who the enemy was, and it was a lot easier to discern that enemy versus looking at ourselves as the enemy. And I believe that integration kind of refined that ability. And it was actually a program you did years ago with Umuligbo Baruti, where he compared integration to the whole process of a woman being in an abusive relationship. And he said, you know, when the woman lives in the same house with her husband, it's easier for him to abuse her because she's right there in the house and he can, you know, physically assault her and stop her from doing things that he doesn't want her to do. Yet if she was to run across town to her mother's house, then that would change the dynamic simply because he doesn't have immediate access to her. And what I see as far as what she was discussing in regards to integration and the way it shifted the consciousness of black people when it took place, is that white people did the same thing in reverse. Originally, they didn't want anything to do with us. We were cordoned off in our own areas, and we only were able to be amongst and even financially spend and do anything and everything amongst ourselves. So even though they still had control, of course, but we were basically put in one space in all the different places we were across the country, and we did not have access to white people unless they allowed us that access. Whereas I believe that when they refined the system, then segregation turned to integration, and they realized they could do much worse to the black psyche as far as confusion and perpetuating the system of white supremacy ad infinitum by living amongst us, because it basically brought our guard down. We started to think, because we live closer to these white folks, we might have a white neighbor that lived next door, that they have changed in some way, even though the behavior and the treatment both covertly and overtly was still white supremacist. And I think that was the linchpin in destroying our ability to really understand better the system that we're dealing with. So I just wanted to throw that out there. Thank you so much. I'll try and listen to the entire next segment so I can chime in a little bit more. And then I'll have the book by next week so I can really follow along like I want to. So I can't wait to hear the archive. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Take care of your stomach, man. If there are other folks
who have commentary or questions they would like to share, feel free. Dial in. We have about 20 minutes or so before we get to the second audio segment. Some of the comments that I had, I thought it was important that the title of the book is The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. It's not politics and racism, it's politics and race in the age of Obama, which I think is important. I know there are a number of different books, films, projects that are dealing with racism, but they do everything they can to avoid use of the term racism, where they'll go back and use race, which in my view, people not understanding that race is racism. The only reason to belong to a member of a race is to practice racism. The only race is the white race. Nobody else belongs to a race. That the whole purpose of that concept is about mistreating individuals that you classify as not white. You are not part of our race, our gang, and you deserve to be stomped on forever on that basis. I think that's very consistent. I think even we had Khalid Gooding. They did the book, You Mean There's Race in My Movie, and they talked, when he was a guest on the program, he talked specifically about they use the term race, not racism, and that happens frequently. People trying to pussyfoot around the truth of white supremacy, racism. Certainly we're not going to use white supremacy. This was challenging for me to read. I didn't listen to Gwen Ifill like every day, but I certainly had heard her a number of times. Heard and seen her on PBS. And reading this book, it feels very much like, I feel like this is very representative of what I remember about that period of time. Like I said, this book was published right after President Obama won the election. So if you can like remember what it was like November, December of 2008, right on into the inauguration in January of 2009. If you kind of remember what the time was like then, this book feels very much like that time. Like it's almost nauseating, like the optimism and the rhetoric that was just everywhere at that time. I mean, it was stifling. You couldn't breathe. The hope and change and what progress and shit. I mean, just all of it. I think this is It is a brilliant timestamp for what it was like right when President Obama was elected. And even that the talk that we began with, that was right in that same period of time. It was right a couple days after the inauguration in January of 2009. So it's challenging for me, and it very much has the same feeling. I don't know if I've said this on the air, but there were black people when I first started seriously studying counter-racism and thinking of white supremacy racism as a system and a science, and really studying, understanding what it means to be white, they are our enemies, and paying attention to words, how words are used when we talk about racism. I saw two non-white people, two black males that I thought were very, very informed about racism, right? Previously in life, they went on the Bill Maher show, and it was painful seeing how Bill Maher manipulated the entire conversation just with words. He was just able to totally dominate the conversation, and seeing these victims not employing counter-racist logic, just seeing that on display, it was just like, wow, this problem is much worse than what I originally thought. And that's the feeling that I've had the whole time, right, that we've been doing this. Even when I decided, all right, we're going to do this book. She just passed away. Let's, you know, study some of her life and times. It was like, wow, like, she's a victim of racism. I'm a victim of racism. I'm still learning. But just when I see victims of racism who are talking about writing, sharing their views on racism, white supremacy, and it's clear that there is an absence of counter-racist logic, either just because they don't understand or they're in a position where they cannot be truthful about race for whatever reason, it's not there. It's obvious, and generally it's very, very difficult for me to you know, enjoy what they have to say or to even be patient with what they have to say, because it just, it will be a lot of things that just don't make sense. So to pick out some specific things, there are so many metaphors in this book. I am gagging on, literally on the metaphors. This is not like a style issue. Pardon for 1 second. This is not a style issue, right? Like, I just prefer a different type of writing. This is getting right to the core of writing and being clear about what it is you say. When you write and you just have lots of metaphors, we have situations that already happened where people can take literally something that you meant metaphorically. That happens frequently. We've already had an example of that. And then sandpaper change. I have no idea what that means. That phrase is in this book more than 50 times. We've already heard it like about a dozen times, I think. Sandpaper change, sandpaper politics, and it's not even explained. Like, these are like basic fundamental things that I would tell anybody. Like, if you're going to, you know, I would not assume that everybody knows what that means. And particularly when we're talking in a context of racism, I would not make any assumption that people know what you're talking about. I have no idea what sandpaper change means. When she starts going through, when she says, we had some interesting use of the term fair as well. When she's talking about this whole demographic shift, I remember there was a lot of that, and you still hear that now. And I think some of this, again, is just we're reading this on the eve of the Trump administration. So it's certainly going to be a very different read as opposed to what it may have sounded like, what it may have read like back in, you know, 2009, end of 2008. But I mean, reading it now, it just, I would say it almost, it just sounds way, way off a field in terms of what actually is, what we're looking at almost at 2017. But yeah, when she's talking about the demographic shift and how this is powering change and black people coming into office and all of that, it just, to me, it just represents that fundamental misunderstanding of racism, white supremacy. You could have a lot. You could have a significantly higher population of non-white people, and that might not change how the system of racism operates very much in this area of the world. Certainly is not going to end it. The operation might look a little different, and it might not. It might look, you know, painfully similar to what we've had all along. The main thing being that white supremacy is still in effect, even with these alleged demographic shifts. Continuing when she begins to talk about Boston, and it again, when it gets presented, when they're talking about the school situation in Boston, it gets presented as black children don't like white children don't like black children. That's not what this is at all. It's not even close, and it's not just a demographic shift at all. This is about white power and maintaining white power in all areas of people activity. I was a little bit surprised for her to talk about that incident and racism in Boston and not get the Charles Stewart incident, the white guy who killed his pregnant white wife and blamed it on a black person. And they ransacked all these black neighborhoods and, you know, roughed up all these black people before he committed suicide, admitted that he did it himself. I was kind of shocked that didn't come up. But some other things. Question I'm throwing out there, people want to respond when she says Jackson scared people and he was perfectly aware of it. What do people make of that? Do we think that white people at any point in history have been, quote unquote, scared of Jesse Jackson? Do we take that literally? Do we take that metaphorically? I'm just putting that out if people want to respond. Some of the other things that I picked up, I found some of the articles that are linked. I'm reading the Kindle version, so they're easily accessible. I tracked down some of the articles that people want to follow. Let's see. The Bradley effect, I thought it was great. The female caller that dialed in first, where she said it seemed like that was in effect this election, which is exactly what I said, where you had the exact same thing, where it seemed like a lot of white people lied and said that they were not going to vote for Trump, and then they did go and vote for Trump. It seemed to be totally in effect this election. And I have mentioned this concept before. I note it because it's another instance. The system of white supremacy likes to make sure that the focus, the attention, is never on whites. It should not be named after Mr. Bradley, this black male who lost his bid for political office in California. This should be named after the whites who were suspected of lying about who they were going to vote for. they make sure, even when they are allegedly indicating, calling out concepts and ways that racism is practiced, they're still attaching it to a non-white person's name. Another even maybe form of showcasing. Let's see. Doug Wilder, Virginia, first black governor. Appreciated his bit of honesty. Let's see. I thought it was important as well when she is saying that, you know, the Bradley effect did not happen with President Obama, that white people did come out and vote. What I think is most important is that the majority of white people did not vote for President Obama. Even the stats that she has in the book, 43% of them voted for him in the 2008 election. The majority of white people did not vote for President Obama in either presidential election. That's the thing that I think is most important. And in fact, more a higher percentage of whites voted for Donald Trump than for President Obama. That, I think, is more glaring, way more significant than all of the rhetoric and how much we want to try and flower it up that 43% of the population voted for this nigra, as though that means they are not racist. That seems to be a major theme of this, too, as though white people being willing to vote for a nigra represents goodness, as though they're not racist, represents things improving. And I mean, again, some of this is going to be painful just because hindsight is real, real blatant, real flagrant. And I mean, clearly, you have a lot of white people that practice racism, white supremacy, and they have had no problem voting for a black person, having sex with a black person, whatever the case may be. A couple other things I will get in. Metaphors: Obama's relentless and disciplined giant slaying campaign is by no means the only story. I have no idea what that means. Let's see. I had a moment of Jesse Jackson Jr., his legal troubles. That's the other thing, too. Like, this is presented as though things are so great. You've got all of these black elected officials. When she's talking about all of these black elected mayors, you mean black elected mayors like Kwame Kilpatrick? You mean black elected mayors like Ray Nagin? You mean black elected officials like Jesse Jackson Jr.? All of whom have had to, unfortunately, spend time in greater confinement since this book was published. But that's kind of what I mean. It seems grossly, I would almost be willing to say, it seems like it would be accurate to say, like, recklessly inaccurate in describing the power dynamics, the politics of racism, white supremacy, particularly with hindsight in evaluating some of these. I will see if I had lots of highlights because there were so many metaphors and things that I didn't think were accurate or making things as clear as they should be. I'll get out two more things and then I will hush, see if other folks have comments, if people want to respond to if they think Jesse Jackson was frightening to white people or is now. Let's see. The first thing, the leader, I think it's really important. This just goes to counter-racist logic. What is a leader? Very important. Maybe that's a question people should ask. What do you mean when you say leader? So I'll know specifically. This is what a person has to be able to do to qualify to be a leader. I submit Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., he stated consistently, counter-racist logic dictates a leader cannot be subject to racism, white supremacy. If you are a victim of racism, you are not qualified to be a leader. You can be a spokesperson. Maybe it might just be that we're not using the most accurate term to describe what we're talking about or to describe what people are doing. But you can have spokespersons who go out and speak about racism. That might qualify for Dr. King, Fannie Lou Hamer, Rosa Parks, Assata Shakur, Minister Malcolm X, whomever. Sure, great. These are spokespeople, not leaders. I think that would be better, and I think it would help us to solve problems, not thinking that this person is going to be able to do things that are not in line with reality, because I think a lot of times we end up having a lot of expectations that are not reality-based because we're just not looking at things accurately within the system of racism, white supremacy. Last thing I will get in, there seemed to be a big section where she was talking about all of the blunders. And I think that was kind of like the terminology that was used when President Obama back in 2008, when he was running for office, when she talked about all these different white people I think Joe Biden, who said he was clean and articulate, and I think it was a whole list of people. I can't believe I didn't highlight it. I'm sure I'll pull it up here, but where she listed these people, and it was as though when they made these comments that were things a racist would say, it was as though they were ignorant. It was as though these were just mistakes. These were just dopish errors, as opposed to white people practicing racism and maybe knowingly and deliberately practicing racism. It still got chalked up to white ignorance, which is very, very common. That's a part of the way that we're programmed. Might even be difficult to get a book published if you take an opposite stance. I will stop there. This was a bestseller in 2009 as well. That might be something to keep in mind. The other question I was going to toss out, who do we think the audience is for the book? Is this a book written for everybody? Is this a book written for white people? Is this a book written for black people? Who do we think the audience, who is she talking to when she's writing this book? I'll throw that out as well. If folks want to respond to either of those questions or you had your own thoughts you wanted to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I would say that I think the audience that the book was written for was probably non-white people. And I totally and emphatically agree with you that because of the time capsule that the book is, as far as the time that it was written and the whole air of, you know, the potential of Obama being the second coming, which is essentially kind of what that whole time frame was like, I agree with you, that in hindsight, now that all of this time has passed, I could see why you said it was nauseating. And the reason why is I agree, I feel the same way. And it's because I think simply that since the civil rights movement, which turned out not to really, you know, get black people anywhere in the system of white supremacy outside of basically cosmetic change, I think that the election of President Obama is probably one of the worst things that ever happened to black people in this country, simply because it just refined their practice. It really put a black face on everything that could have possibly gone wrong during his tenure as president. And also, he basically inherited a lot of all of the things that Bush got wrong. And then he inherited and subsequently got blamed for all of those things. So really, to me, this book, reading it, just what you alluded to earlier, what I was discussing, you alluded to earlier, really just brings home the fact that President Obama is just a victim of white supremacy and absolutely couldn't do anything without complete white approval and sanction while he was in office. And I think it's glaringly evident now. And reading that text will make it even more glaringly evident, I believe, simply because at that time there was so much promise for things to change and the audacity of hope. So the entire country was just reeling from the fact that we couldn't imagine a black man even being elected at that point. Most people thought that even, you know, that it would be another 100 years before a black person would be in office. So just the whole mindset of that cosmetic change that, oh, wow, you know, they put a black male in office. So now black people started to assume that there were more so-called good white people and things of that nature. And I think that everything that you alluded to is perfectly spot on when you talked about the use of words. Perfect and spot on as usual, and is very accurate in your assessment. Do I think that white people were scared of Jesse Jackson? Absolutely not. If he did become president back then, they could have assassinated him, just like they could have assassinated President Obama. And they let President Obama know multiple occasions with the guy who jumped over the fence on the White House lawn, the couple that was not no connection to Obama or his presidency that ended up in the party in the White House, and no one could account for who they were, where they came from. So essentially, no, they had no fear of Jesse Jackson. And ultimately, what they did to his son and Kwame Kilpatrick and Ray Nagin, they could have and would have done to him. It's either put him in jail or set him up to be put in jail down the road or basically assassinate him if that was the case. So absolutely not. White people are not scared of Jesse Jackson at all. They have no reason to be scared of him. And that's my opinion. Thank you so much. And I'll mute my line.
Other folks, appreciate that, Roz. Other folks, if you want to respond to either the questions about Jesse Jackson, intended audience, or if you had any other points that you wanted to make sure you share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just want to echo what Roz said about Jesse Jackson. Yes, white people weren't scared of Jesse Jackson.
they were just a little surprised on his support, but, you know, white people will kill their own if they're scared of them. So, yeah, Jesse Jackson would have been assassinated if they were legitimately scared of him. So that's all I want to add.
Dig it. The caller at 7722, did you have commentary?
Yes. Thank you. Greetings to the host and the guest. My response regarding the question on Jesse Jackson, I've been reluctant to comment on this book. I did not follow Gordon Ifill very closely, and so I try to have a very open opinion about her, her writing. However, I can't help but think of Dr. Tommy Curry when he talks about the role of some of the Black Boule, and this, and I believe you alluded to it, Gus, when you said it was almost.
Hang on a second. The term Boule should never be used on this program, ever, ever. That's just name calling, and Dr. Tommy Curry has never used the term Boule. I have heard him use the term bourgeois. That is not Boule. And every time I've heard Boule, it's just been used as means to name call other Black people. Unless somebody can, like today, put their hand on a segment where Dr. Tommy Curry mentioned the Boule. I've never heard him use that term on the program ever.
Yeah, I was mistaken. I feel it was very distant from reality as far as my her writing style, and I feel that it was because it was a number one seller. Obviously, it was made for a white audience, but I do enjoy her analysis of Jesse Jackson and his run for presidency. I wasn't very old at that time, so I did enjoy hearing her analysis of it because I just haven't heard a lot of details of it. I'll take my call offline.
Appreciate that. Just try to that people, not you specifically, call it. Just I do try to make sure we stick to that with the name calling thing, because people do sometimes victims get way out of hand with the name calling, and we do want us to make sure we stick to the no name calling policy on the program. But appreciate that as well, sir. Other folks, anybody else, comments they wanted to share, if you wanted to respond to the two questions, or if you had your own insight or thoughts you wanted to share. We have about 10 minutes before we get to the second audio.
I'll comment on the, I don't think the white people were scared of Jesse Jackson. I mean, I was younger too, but I just don't. I don't think white people are scared like that. And I wanted to also comment on the name of the book being The Breakthrough, and The Breakthrough being the politics. And I just don't seem, I mean, politics are something that you would get into to make changes. And I just don't seem like, it just doesn't feel like a lot of changes have been made. There are a lot of Black people that are in politics, a large number of Black people that are in politics, but I just don't see a lot of changes that have been made. And by it being The Breakthrough, and The Breakthrough are supposed to be politics, I mean, when Black people are in politics, they just, you know, you're a Black person at work, you know, and you can only do, you know, what, as much as you can do at work. And so you tap out. I mean, you top out. Every Black person, you know, tops out at work. They can only do so much. And then there's, I don't know, there's some, there'll be some racist white supremacist there to, you know, let you know this is it. You can only do this. We can't let you go any further than this. And that's what I wanted to say about that.
For sure. Racists will let you know what the deal is. Other folks have commentary they wanted to get in last few minutes. Also wanted to make sure I got in as well. Again, as I said, Miss Eiffel, she's a victim of racism, but just also I think it's important the timing of when this book came out. There were a lot of books that came out, like, in this time frame, that first, like, 6-month period from, like, November to April.
there were a lot of books written on race and Obama in that period of time. And for this to become a bestseller, she was already a well-known journalist. She had, you know, written for the New York Times and the Washington Post, and for decades put her time and service in doing quality work, award-winning journalist. Just something about the tone, the rhetoric of the book. It's not very long. We're going to be done very quick. It's not very long. There's a lot of political rhetoric, a lot of the rhetoric and jargon of the day. Some of the jargon that's internal just to this book, the sandpaper politics and sandpaper change, whatever that means, that's used so much. There is a kind of inauthentic feel to it, just kind of something packaged quickly. Not that she didn't do her research, but just seeming like we already kind of know the style in terms of the writing. We already kind of know how we want this to sound, the tone we want this to take, the presentation. It's not going to upset white people very much. It's not going to be very accurate about racism, white supremacy. It's going to be very Pollyanna. Pollyanna meaning almost sickeningly optimistic in the presentation. That's kind of what I'm getting. And again, a lot of this is, what can I say? We sit days from President Trump. What can I say? I could pussyfoot just out of, well, she just passed away last month, and I don't want to make it seem like I'm, you know, trashing a book that a black person wrote about racism. But I mean, I don't know what else one can say. Days from President Trump, and having had 8 years to evaluate all this, I don't know what else one can say if you're going to honestly read this book at this moment. Am I talking crazy? Is anyone sitting? Are there any people out there who are like, "Hey, this is grand reading. I'm learning a lot, and I think that this is accurately discussing racism, white supremacy." Is anybody out listening taking that position? Because we definitely need to hear from you. Because I could be talking loony here.
I would say not at all, not at all, not accurately speaking about white supremacy. And I think some of the points you brought up alludes. And the title being The Breakthrough is why I think the book was written for black people and non-white people, because white people don't have to break through anything. It's us that have been perpetually suppressed, oppressed, abused, racially terrorized and genocided. And just the title is why I said it was written for black people. And the reason I think it became a bestseller, this is just my opinion, I could be wrong, is because it was not offensive to white people. And somewhere in there, I believe that white people were checking up on what was in the text to make sure that it did not speak in a manner that was accurate about racism. And I think that's part of the reason it became a bestseller. But to what gave me the inkling that specifically was written for black people and non-white people was the title, The Breakthrough. And to me, that also alludes to the refinement of white supremacy, because just the whole premise of the book, that, like you said, that Pollyanna approach to the Obama election and presidency ultimately will give the masses of grassroots black people the impression that something has changed, or that change is going to come with Obama. Because at that point, he was basically almost worshipped at that point. He was being looked upon as this guy that was going to transform American politics. And now 8 years later, we can find that very little, if anything, has been done at all in reference to change, and especially when it comes to black people and white supremacy and him addressing white supremacy. Actually, things have gotten worse for black people with him in office the entire time he was president. And I believe it's going to get even worse once, Donald Trump steps into office and further facilitates the overt version and reconstruction of white supremacy that will be coming up in January when he takes office. Thank you.
Anybody else? Final comment before we get to the second audio segment? Anybody?
I have another comment, but I'm going to have to jump on the train, try to get some other jobs, so I'm going to have to pick it up when I get off. So hold me to it, please.
We will do that. We will do that. Travel safely on the train. We will go ahead and get to the second audio segment. And if anyone out there, if you had additional commentary, if you didn't get to share, just jot down a note and we should have ample time to share once the second audio segment concludes. So we're in chapter one, unless I'm mistaken. I'm still in chapter one here, kind of midway through. This is Gwen Ifill, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number two.
There is yet a tougher question. Do all African Americans even want the same things? It's lazy and simple to lump them all together as a group that harbors the same grievances and aspirations. In fact, as a 2007 National Public Radio Pew Research Center poll of more than 1,000 African Americans showed, African Americans are no monolith. 61% said they saw more differences than similarities between the values of middle class and poor blacks. The same Pew report also found that more than one-third of African Americans believe that blacks are too diverse to be thought of as a single race. The gulf, the report concluded, existed between middle class and poor blacks. Interestingly enough, it was not a case of the bourgeoisie looking down its nose at the underclass. Their survey showed poorer blacks were the ones more likely to see the existence of a gap between the poor and the middle class in what had come to be branded family values. Although conservatives had appropriated a term that came to be a politically loaded one, it turns out poor folks own the term too. Perhaps African Americans have already reached a turning point, at least in theory. After all, Bill Cosby can sell Jell-O, Oprah Winfrey can sell books, and Michael Jordan can sell Hanes underwear. Denzel Washington outranks Tom Hanks as America's favorite movie star. Why shouldn't black politicians be equally acceptable to the majority? One of the things all these well-known names have in common is the ability to short-circuit white guilt. None of these popular figures seems to be pointing the finger of blame. How could race still be a problem in America if white people could now identify with black entertainers and athletes, if Bill Cosby was welcome in their homes? No less a political figure than Republican Karl Rove made just such a point during Fox News' election night coverage in 2008. David Bisaitis, senior research associate at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies in Washington, senses the mood has been shifting for decades as access to the education afforded by civil rights advances, including desegregation and affirmative action, has created a new breed of black politician able to straddle the racial divide. You started seeing younger black elected officials who more and more had the profile of what more prominent white elected officials had, he says. If you look at a lot of the candidates for president, they went to Ivy League schools or law schools or business schools, and you started seeing that in black candidates. And those are the kind of credentials that white voters expect in the kind of people they're going to support for statewide office. Beginning in the early 1990s, Bisaitis' Joint Center polling also began documenting a generational divide among black Americans that eventually began to drive a shift in political priorities. One quarter of young black voters now describe themselves as conservatives, and nearly a third say they are moderates. The remaining group, 48%, describe themselves as liberal. Fully two-thirds of them support arm's-length solutions such as school choice and the partial privatization of Social Security. Blacks over the age of 40, by contrast, oppose school vouchers. Wasn't this, after all, what Whitney Young, John Lewis, and Barbara Jordan were reaching for? Is this not true diversity of thought as well as action? Colin Powell was, for a time, the prototype of a non-traditional political figure. He was already 58 years old and a much decorated and admired retired general, years before the Second Iraq War sullied his reputation, when he was lured into a deep and serious flirtation with the presidency in 1995. His mulling gripped the political world, including many white assignment editors, who were convinced Powell would be the breakthrough. Reporters like me were sent on long-term political stakeout to divine his interests and intentions. While working for NBC News that fall, I traveled all the way to London just to corner Powell in a BBC green room while he was on a book tour. The general, whom I then knew only slightly, was startled to see me, but not so caught off guard that he declared his candidacy to me. Powell wrote later that he was desperately torn about his decision, swayed alternately by pressure from Republicans, Democrats, and independents. Everyone took turns trying to convince him he could be the candidate to transcend race and party. He had, after all, been the first Black four-star general, the first Black chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Why not be the Black Eisenhower as well? That decision was left to his wife, Alma, a sweet-natured but tough-minded military wife who possessed a will of steel and a sharp instinct. That instinct told her it was not safe for her husband or for any other Black man to run for president. Not yet. When Powell ultimately announced his decision not to run at a packed news conference in a Washington hotel ballroom only months after the Powell for President frenzy began, Alma, standing by his side, looked only relieved. Powell declared that running for president would require a calling that I do not yet hear. But even as he stepped away, he seemed to sense the change in the air. In one generation, he declared, we have moved from denying a Black man service at a lunch counter to elevating one to the highest military office in the nation and to being a serious contender for the presidency. But in deciding not to run, Powell never tested the idea of whether the nation was, at that time, truly ready for a Black commander-in-chief. The question lingered as to whether or not that would have been a serious problem, he told me a dozen years later as we chatted in his post-retirement office in Alexandria, Virginia. Many of my close friends and relatives said, Colin, don't believe it. When they go into that booth, they're not going to vote for a colored man. Plus, Powell was not that impressed by all the first Black stuff. When people marveled to him that he was the first, say, Black Secretary of State, he thought, is there a first white one somewhere? This is not to say that Powell is not proud of his accomplishments. He's just weary, in the way so many firsts are, of being given primary credit for the life factor he had the least control over, his race. Powell's decision to remove himself from electoral politics was also a blow to the Republican Party, and one from which it has never quite recovered. When Oklahoma Congressman J.C. Watts left Congress in 2002, he was the last of the Black Republicans there. By the time 2008 arrived, not a single credible Black Republican candidate was running for the House, for the Senate, or for governor in any of the 50 states. Powell would not have been the first Black candidate for president. That distinction belongs to Shirley Chisholm, the tart and bespectacled immigrant's daughter who in 1968 was the first African-American woman elected to Congress. Chisholm was ahead of her time and, aside from their shared West Indian ancestry, unlike Powell in almost every way. She had chosen politics, not the military, as her path to public service. And she took pride in her reputation as a maverick both in her Brooklyn district and on Capitol Hill. Mavericks were not exactly welcome in the early years of Black political power on Capitol Hill. When she decided to run for the Democratic nomination in 1972, other Black elected officials, including members of Congress, were among her fiercest critics. In his book on the history of the Congressional Black Caucus, former Representative William L. Clay Sr. called her candidacy grandiose. Ohio's Lewis Stokes called it an ego trip. Both men were elected to Congress on the same day in 1968 that Chisholm was, but they were not close. No matter how unrealistic, she was entitled to her hallucinations, Clay wrote. Ronald V. Dellums, who initially endorsed Chisholm, switched to George McGovern, the eventual nominee. Chisholm's candidacy appealed to some feminists and some African Americans, but she ultimately earned only 5% of the vote in the Democratic primaries. L. Douglas Wilder, the former Virginia governor who is now the mayor of Richmond, launched his own, almost unnoticed, nine-month run for the nomination in 1992. His effort was short-lived and marked by what turned into an unseemly feud with the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who himself had run for president twice. Jackson did not feel Wilder was giving him his due. Wilder simply did not like Jackson. But Jackson ran the most serious national campaign prior to Obama's. In 1988, his second presidential campaign, he managed to win 13 primary contests and 7 million votes. The Jackson Wilder feud is but one example of a more perilous straddle for black politics, negotiating the friction within the black community itself. It is one of the delicately untold stories of our time. The problem? No one wants to air the dirty laundry. When popular talk show host Tavis Smiley dared to voice his doubts about Obama early on in the presidential race, many of his African-American viewers and listeners turned on him in force. Still, this type of intra-racial political friction is not as unusual as it may seem. When there are only so many ladders available to climb, the struggle to maintain one's hold on any one rung can become intense. When thousands of activists descended on Jenna, Louisiana in 2007 to protest the imprisonment of 6 black teenagers, Jackson made headlines by criticizing Obama for not joining the march. Obama, Jackson told a reporter, was acting white. He later said he didn't recall using those words and released a statement reiterating his support for the Obama candidacy. But Jackson's diffidence about Obama became a recurring theme, one he later said he came to regret, even as he acknowledged the strain that began to build between the two Illinois politicians. "It's not a hostile tension necessarily, though it can be at times," he told me months later. "There's a creative tension that makes for change. You reshape iron when it's hot." Al Sharpton, another political lightning rod, played the 2008 presidential race card differently. For a time, he served as closet advisor to both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, even saving their pleading calls on his cell phone to play back for reporters. He laughs when people tell him the success of civil rights outsiders such as Obama renders insiders such as himself obsolete. That, he has said, would be like expecting soul singer James Brown to have made crooner Sammy Davis Jr. obsolete. "I think white America wants to make us all one dimension," he told me one morning over breakfast. "Okay, we've got one black at a time. Jesse had his day," he said. "Al was there, and then now Barack. But that ain't how it is." Indeed, Sharpton is less troubled by Obama's rise than some who would believe the black community can sustain only one leader at a time might expect. The two held one very public meeting over fried shrimp at Sylvia's, the famous Harlem soul food emporium, but Sharpton had enough self-awareness about his political radioactivity to stay mostly behind the scenes after that. "I don't think that white media gives white folks credit for having good sense," Sharpton said. "They understand that a Barack Obama's got to deal with me at some level. They just don't want to see I'm controlling it. White folks ain't crazy now." Sharpton acknowledges the difference between his approach and strategies developed by the new generation of black politicians banging their heads against the ceiling of power politics. They are almost all middle class, college educated, and comfortable in multiracial situations. They are not the 1960s stereotype of a civil rights leader. When it comes to ambition, they take much from the Doug Wilders, the Jesse Jacksons, and the Colin Powells, but they reject much as well. Like a ship maneuvering its way through a narrow channel, they embrace civil rights politics when it helps and move past it when it does not. We are in the aftermath of a black freedom struggle that ended in 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan. Eddie Glaude Jr., a professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton, told me, "We're talking about a period post-mass struggle. We're talking about different conditions under which young people come of age politically." And there are the shapeshifters. Harold Ford Jr., a Democrat who lost his U.S. Senate race in 2006, is a card-carrying member of the National Rifle Association and uses his platform as chairman of the Moderate Democratic Leadership Council to argue for a more conservative brand of Democratic politics. Michael Steele, a Republican who missed his chance to be elected to the U.S. Senate from Maryland that same year, is trying to do much the same for his party as chairman of GOPAC, a Republican think tank. Neither man adheres to the traditional orthodoxies of black politics. Each is more impressed by what he sees in the business world than by what he sees in politics. During the 2007 celebration honoring the 50th anniversary of the integration of Little Rock Central High School, Ford, then a vice chairman at Merrill Lynch, told an audience how he walked into a dinner meeting of black CEOs in New York, sat down, and thought, this is the America that Dr. King was talking about. Likewise, Steele argues for the need to move beyond the traditional civil rights paradigm. This generation is less interested in having a seat at the lunch counter and more interested in owning the diner, says Steele. That is the difference between those who marched and those who now follow behind that march. Indeed, there have always been different routes to progress. Powell did not take part in civil rights marches. He was serving in the Army. I thought that my job, since I wasn't going to march, was to take advantage of what those who had marched had created, Powell says. But I never had any illusions that it was all over. In his autobiography, Powell describes the Army as a natural destination for a young black man in the 1960s because it harbored less discrimination, a truer merit system, and leveler playing fields than any southern city hall or northern corporation. The Army, therefore, made it easier for me to love my country, he wrote, with all its flaws, and to serve her with all my heart. In that respect, Powell, now 71, has something in common with the generation currently rising to power. Only 9% of the black elected officials 18 to 40 years old were active in the civil rights movement, as opposed to 68% of the politicians who came before them. As institutional barriers fell, especially with the 1965 enactment of the Voting Rights Act, politics became more integrated. These guys have taken an unprecedented leap into the Grand Canyon of history, said Wayne Curry, the former executive of Maryland's majority black Prince George's County. There's no precedent for it, and there's no roadmap. They're pioneers, and like all explorers and pioneers, some will make it to the ultimate destination, some won't. But somebody behind them will come along and follow as close as they could, and of course, if they can find the map, maybe get a little further. But maps are not that dependable when the roads are still under construction. As Michael Steele notes, integrating lunch counters is now an antiquated and unnecessary concept. Has anyone born in the drive-through age ever even eaten at a lunch counter? We don't go out and march, Julius L. Chambers, legendary civil rights attorney and former president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, told me prior to Obama's election. We don't have the protests that we had before. Today, we can run for Congress and the Senate, and we can have some clout in venues other than the court. The one thing that is still missing is our ability to use all three of those areas, the executive, the legislative, the courts. Overall, I don't see the young folks coming along as being threats, said Joe Reed, a longtime black Democratic leader in Alabama. The only thing I see as being a threat, in my opinion, is that they want so bad to get there that they forget who they are. That's what we have to watch. Former Congressman Dellums has shuttled through each of these political worlds, returning to his hometown of Oakland, California, to run for mayor after decades in Washington. 40 years ago, we tried to change the world, Dellums told me. Civil rights movements were very important, and then suddenly, somewhere along the way, people said, okay, integrating at the lunch counter is cool, but you gotta have a job. Integrating the college and the university is okay, that's fine, but you got to have the resources to be able to get there. Integrating a neighborhood is fine, but you got to have a job to buy a home, pay the mortgage. So suddenly, it was not just about civil rights in the abstract and about the law, it was justice, economic justice, social justice, and it expanded to environmental justice. Until recently, whatever group protest that was to be found in the black community sprang from the churches, the only organizations blacks truly controlled. Now it finds its home on the internet, and most of today's marches are more a form of nostalgia or solidarity than a forum for demand. At practically every level, black politics has been transformed. Not everyone agrees it's all for the good. There is a 21st century black politician, and then there are 21st century black politics, said Diane Wilkerson, who recently lost her seat as the first and so far only African American in the Massachusetts State Senate. Not necessarily, she said, always the same thing. If that's true, it's because black politicians have been transformed, many of them a step ahead of the communities they represent. Increasingly, they are a generation who have reaped the fruits of the civil rights movement and are applying, investing those benefits in different ways. That generational leadership is occurring at a time when a number of other forces are converging, which make the challenge of this new generation of politicians in many respects even more difficult than the challenges that faced the previous generation, said Wade Henderson, the executive director of the Leadership Council on Civil Rights. The forces, which include competing ambitions and disagreements over how to define true progress, are not only converging, they are colliding. As young people began graduating from the schools that would not have accepted their parents and taking jobs at the companies that would not have employed them, the political landscape began shifting as well. Henderson sees only potential in all this. There is room, he says, for bridge building that goes beyond threat of protest, backroom deal making, and moral outrage preached from a pulpit. Plus, he says, there are new challenges and opportunities on the horizon for politicians of every stripe in a nation where nearly 1 in 5 Americans speak something other than English at home. Coalition politics is the politics of the 21st century, said Henderson, who was impressed when he saw Newark's Cory Booker slide effortlessly into Spanish at a news conference. Politicians who ignore that do so at their own peril, he said. They either will not be elected or they won't be elected long if they are not within the realm of transition. And transition is happening all over the country. Indeed, Obama beat John McCain in part because he attracted more than 2/3 of the Latino vote. With that transition comes some risk. There is not a black politician, business person, or academic in existence who has not grappled with the dilemma of making sure he or she is heard in a majority environment unused to African Americans' presence. Kendrick Meek, an African American member of Congress from Florida, told me that on Capitol Hill, some of his best friends, as they say, are white, and he is keenly aware that many of those colleagues have put him in a racial box. America outside of Black America, he told me, is looking at us and saying, can I trust them? Do they carry that anger? One feature of the Obama effect, as I have come to label it, is that whites are more comfortable with black candidates who do not seem to carry that anger, while blacks are often more suspicious. For every rising star, there is a cautionary tale. In this audio program, I will focus on Obama's story and also on the stories of 3 other such ambitious young men who are redefining the future of black politics as beneficiaries of the Obama effect. There's no doubt there are some white voters that find an African-American candidate exciting, that find a Latino candidate exciting, or an Asian candidate exciting, said David Plouffe, who managed Obama's presidential campaign and also worked to elect Deval Patrick in Massachusetts. But I think, he said, for the most part, it's more about the message and that the people you're looking at, certainly Booker, Patrick, Obama, have a message that we really need to turn the page here. Few of these successful black politicians claim to have pulled off success on their own, but those who marched back then often turn out to be the biggest critics of those who are poised to take over now. This debate, largely invisible to mainstream eyes, continues to play out with no small amount of ferocity in church basements, black think tanks, and anywhere civil rights leaders meet. Former Congressman Floyd Flake, now president of historically black Wilberforce University, and pastor of a 23,000-member African Methodist Episcopal congregation in Queens, New York, believes the key is for the next generation of leaders to step beyond the politically liberal confines of the traditional civil rights movement. I think, he said, what is happening is you're seeing the first step away from the traditional civil rights kind of leader. I think the upside is great, but I don't think you can say we're there yet. Vernon Jordan, the Washington attorney, moved on from his civil rights roots to a lucrative and high-octane career in law, on Wall Street, and on corporate boards. Nearly any Democrat who aspires to power has made his or her way to Jordan's Northwest Washington home. The same was true for Obama, but Jordan remained a staunch Clinton supporter throughout the 2008 primaries, rallying to Obama's side only after his old friend lost. What he sees missing is the mentoring he remembers receiving from his elders when he was rising through the movement. I think that's one of the differences, he told me. there is not much laying on of hands now. So I asked him, is it that the laying on of hands from the elders is being withheld from the new generation? I'm not sure if they're not asking or not listening, he replied. Sandpaper politics. Friction. These are the consequences when power shifts along race, gender, or generational lines. We saw it all play out in the remarkable 2008 election, but when the dust from the breakthrough settles, will the Obama effect have exposed new strengths or new weaknesses? I argue that at the very least, it will reveal a healthy new vision of what breaking through looks like. While the nation's race generals were fighting the old wars, an explosion of black political activism has taken root that now straddles generations, legacies, race and gender identity, and even partisanship. Chapter 2. The Generational Divide. In the beginning, we thought all we needed to do is get into the mainstream. We were too naive to understand that the mainstream was polluted, and that when you get in there, you also have to purify the stream so the whole body politic can survive. The Reverend Joseph Lowery. Andrew Young was sitting behind a little round table in a sports coat and open-necked black shirt in Atlanta on the evening of September 5, 2007, more than a year before Barack Obama was elected president. Seated comfortably across from him in front of the audience was Maynard Eaton, host of a popular Atlanta interview show. Eaton held a microphone in his right hand while, in the back of the room, a camera rolled. Then a Sunday school teacher in the audience posed an open-ended question. What did Young, the former Atlanta mayor, UN ambassador, and civil rights icon, think about Barack Obama? I'd like Barack Obama to be president, Young replied, to a burst of applause from the audience. In 2016, he added. The applauders were caught up short. A few booed. Young continued, and his line of reasoning, coming from a man who had linked arms with Martin Luther King Jr. to march for voting rights when he was decades younger than Obama, was nothing short of amazing. Black men who reach too far, too fast, he said, die early. Maynard Jackson, the first black mayor of Atlanta, would have been alive today, Young said, if he had been older when he ran for mayor. Another former Atlanta mayor, Bill Campbell, who recently completed a 2-year prison sentence for tax evasion, would not have been sent to jail, he said. Even Martin Luther King Jr., who died at the age of 39, would still be alive today if he had not achieved so much so soon. Martin's home got bombed the first year, Young said as the room grew quiet. They took all of his money the second year and sued for income tax evasion. He got stabbed the third year. The fourth year, they took him. It's not a matter of being inexperienced, Young said of Obama in a matter-of-fact tone. It is a matter of being young. Young said he was supporting Hillary Clinton essentially because of Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton, he said, is every bit as black as Barack Obama. This, he said, was because he'd once seen Bill Clinton do a Michael Jackson moonwalk, an image it is hard to conjure. More important, Young's comments revealed, in an unusually candid and naked manner, how little he knew about someone he essentially considered a whippersnapper. He insisted, for instance, that Obama's stepfather was Chinese, although he was Indonesian. He basically did not know this young man who had the temerity to aspire to the presidency. When I asked Young about his comments after it was clear Obama would become president, he attributed his pessimism to a combination of political loyalty to Clinton and deep suspicion about what America would allow. I had a hard time believing the Obama phenomena, he admitted. And it was not that I didn't trust him or that I didn't like him. I liked everything about him. It's just that my experience in American politics has been, well, somewhat treacherous. Young, an ordained minister, often reaches for biblical references to explain himself. I had too many scars from Egypt and wandering in the wilderness to see clearly into the promised land, he said of Obama. The rift between black politicians born in the 1930s and 1940s and those born in the 1960s and 1970s is a deep one that is often papered over. The worldview of the older politicians, many of them preachers like Young, was defined by limitation. They could not eat at lunch counters. They could not sit where they liked on buses or vote how and for whom they liked. They could not attend the schools they preferred or aspire to the jobs they believed they were qualified to hold. Every time one of those barriers fell, it was power seized, not given. They marched, they preached, and they protested. Their children, who walked freely down the streets where their parents marched, were raised to believe they could do anything. Their schools were integrated, and Ivy League colleges came looking for them. "They're idealistic enough not to be carrying the luggage of the older generation," said Dayton, Ohio Mayor Ryan McGlynn, 60 years old, who was lobbied by an impressive series of young Obama aides during the primary campaign. These true believers did not grow up with Jim Crow laws or lynching trials, and they lived in a world shaped by access instead of denial. The prior generation that they replaced defined their position, their mission, their program in opposition to whites, said Christopher Edley Jr., a former Carter and Clinton administration official. And in that sense, the new generation defined their position, their vision, their program in a way that is, again, that word we're looking for, it's not non-racial, it's not post-racial, supra-racial. Whatever the correct label, it set them up for sandpaper conflict, essentially with their own parents. When Chicago pastor Jeremiah Wright's angry preaching and fiery edited videos threatened to unbalance Obama's strained efforts to get past race, the nominee relied on this supra-racial identity to try to bridge the divide. The key, Obama knew, was to find a way to bury the old resentments, not inflame them. The older people have to work very diligently not to allow themselves to get into a time warp, said 72-year-old Ron Dellums. Each generation carries its own baggage, but the challenge of life is to be able to move beyond the baggage, to continue to update and refine, to stay in the moment, to stay in the time, to stay focused on the future, to stay focused, he said. That allows you to move beyond generation. And I think too many of our older people continue to view the world through the same old lens. Shannon Reeves, an outreach advisor for the Republican National Committee and one of the few African Americans in GOP party leadership, puts it more succinctly. "These are the leaders," he told me, "who take the gavel to the grave." But Reeves has a tough job. At the same time as the new leaders are coming of age, the number of African Americans who seem to think the Republican Party is a reasonable alternative is shrinking. Less than 2% of the 2,300 delegates to the 2008 Republican National Convention were black, down from nearly 7% in 2004. Obama garnered 95% of the black vote and 66% of the ballots of voters under the age of 30. "It's embarrassing," said Republican Michael Steele, the former lieutenant governor who was one of the few African-American officials to speak at the GOP convention. Andrew Young, the movement patriarch, stumbled right into this clash with his off-the-cuff remarks about Obama, like so many of the many explosions that were the hallmark of the 2008 presidential campaign. His outburst faded quickly but left marks all over the place. His post-political life has become a cautionary tale about the assumption that wisdom comes with age, columnist Deborah Mathis wrote caustically on blackamericaweb.com. Alas, it isn't necessarily so, and Young is proof. Music is as good a place as any to chart this divide. Obama's iPod included the rapper Jay-Z. Only people under the age of 30 grasped what Obama was doing when he responded to campaign criticism by making a motion as if brushing off his shoulder. Turns out that's a Jay-Z dance move. By contrast, I watched 76-year-old Andrew Young truly get down at a black tie dinner in New York when the jazz combo swung into a version of the durable George Jackson hit, Down Home Blues. Their musical psyches are at least 40 years apart. After it became clear Obama would become his party's nominee, University of Chicago political science professor Michael Dawson noted that criticism from Young and later from millionaire black entertainment television founder and Clinton supporter Robert Johnson may have, in fact, helped Obama. "Closing ranks around an African-American leader perceived to be unfairly under attack," he wrote, "has been a long and honorable tradition since the 19th century." But if you follow the trail the critical footprints left, it was impossible to miss the generational divide. Young Obama voters were the leading edge in enthusiasm and engagement. As the 2008 primary campaign caught fire, participation among voters under 30 quadrupled in Tennessee and tripled in Iowa, Georgia, Missouri, Mississippi, Oklahoma, and Texas. In the general election, Obama improved on 2004 nominee John Kerry's performance with voters under 30 by 12%. John McCain bested Obama only among voters aged 65 and older. You had probably a little over 13 million new voters jumping into the process, Obama pollster Cornell Belcher told me. And among those new voters, Barack Obama won close to 70% of them. Part of his strategy from the beginning was to change the face of the electorate. The distinction between how the old guard gained power and how the newcomers are breaking through is significant. The elders sprang up from a civil rights movement that helped create artfully drawn majority black districts. Once inside the circle, officials elected from those districts, especially in Congress, acquired a power of incumbency that virtually guaranteed re-election year after year after year. The white political power structure, happy with separate but equal, generally looked the other way to protect their own politically safe preserves. But a gulf began to develop as the second and third generations of ambitious black leaders began to come of age at the same time as the venerable leaders began to age out. The big names, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, Vernon Jordan, and Colin Powell, are in their 60s and 70s. Obama and his cohorts are, for the most part, in their 30s, 40s, or at most, 50s, with their own networks and ideas about the best way to seize power. Changing the face of the electorate is a brand new political concept for black politicians. Jackson, who staged his own breakthrough in the 1960s, describes his generation as the demolition crew that got bloodied in order for the latest generation of leaders to walk through the rubble to power. Shifting leadership, he said, reaching for another analogy, is like shifting kitchen personnel without changing the recipe. If you change cooks but don't change the formula, the biscuit won't rise, he told me. There is a lot of media focus on new cooks, but you go in the inner city, nothing has changed. The straddle proved especially difficult for Georgia Congressman John Lewis, a civil rights movement icon who spent the better part of a year torn between Clinton and Obama. On one hand, Lewis remembered keenly what it was like to negotiate the internal growing pains of a nascent movement when he led the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Lewis spent critical years attempting to bridge the gaps in philosophy and execution between blacks and whites, as well as with the more moderate Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Those fights, which featured disputes between historic figures such as King and Stokely Carmichael, made the 2008 dispute seem tame. Plus, the Clintons were his old friends. Shortly before the South Carolina primary, Lewis was out shopping for groceries in Atlanta when the cell phone in his pocket started ringing. It was Bill Clinton on the phone, imploring him to come to the Palmetto State the following day to help him campaign for Hillary in black churches. "You don't say no to the president," he reasoned, and boarded a plane for South Carolina. But Lewis made yet another leap across the generational divide after his own Atlanta district went 3-1 for Obama during the Georgia primary. He switched to Obama. In a politician less admired, it would have been called a flip-flop. But with Lewis, the shift seemed genuinely painful. The process, he told NBC correspondent Andrea Mitchell, was more difficult than getting his head bashed in as he crossed Selma's Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965. "You do have would-be black elected officials or black candidates that have moved far beyond the civil rights rhetoric of my generation," he told me, sitting in a congressional office where every wall is covered in civil rights memorabilia. "And they are able to deal with issues that are human issues. It's not just affirmative action, not just a matter of social justice. These guys and girls believe in social justice and affirmative action and all of that, but something else is out there." Before Lewis abandoned Clinton for Obama, he wrestled quite publicly with the fear that he might end up on the wrong side of history. He was all too keenly aware of the generational chasms opening up all around him. I saw it in Atlanta with some of the old guard toward some of the young people, he said. You hear, they haven't paid their dues. It's not their time. They need to get in line. I think some of the old line black leaders during the 60s, the late 50s and the 60s, wanted us to stay in our places, not get out of line, that we were going too fast, that we were pushing too fast, and they didn't understand this new, young degree of militancy. Other members of the Congressional Black Caucus reported they were threatened or harassed for choosing to support Clinton over Obama. The late Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones of Ohio, a staunch Hillary Clinton supporter, called it Harvard arrogance. The split ran hard and deep among a collection of elected officials who typically walked in lockstep on most issues. You do see the clash because it's generational, said Representative William Lacey Clay, Jr., a 52-year-old black Missouri Democrat who supported Obama. They have a way of doing things in their generation, and they don't really like the way some of us approach issues. But the pressure went deeper than that. Eugene R. Miller, a state lawmaker from Cleveland, said his support for Clinton got him tagged as an Uncle Tom sellout in some areas of his district. There's a lot of pressure to switch sides, he said in the week leading up to the March Ohio primary. There's a lot of emotion. All I can say is thank God it's winter and no one is outside because there would be more than angry words on the street. Even those who tried to straddle the divide came in for their share of reprobation. Democratic National Committee member Donna Brazil remained neutral throughout the primary campaign, but discovered that this did not satisfy her old friends in the Clinton campaign, who built loyalties in the black community the old-fashioned way, through selected elected officials and church-based leaders. Many owed their success to the Clinton organization. You assumed that the traditional black organizers and the black leaders were going to be for you because you birthed us, Brazil said she told her Clinton friends. And I wanted off that plantation. The bad feelings endured on many levels. Both Brazil and another neutral Democrat, South Carolina Representative William Clyburn, the highest-ranking black lawmaker in the House of Representatives, reported finding themselves on the receiving end of Bill Clinton tongue lashings. The figureheads are not actually gatekeepers to the black vote. No disrespect, but they don't speak for us, William Jelani Cobb, a history professor at Spelman College, said as this unfolded. Just a short time earlier, he had written, positioned as he is between the black boomers and the hip-hop generation, Obama is indebted, but not beholden, to the civil rights gerontocracy. A successful Obama candidacy would simultaneously represent a huge leap forward for black America and the death knell for the reign of the civil rights era leadership, or at least the illusion of their influence. Lewis's early support for Clinton earned him not one, but two black challengers when he ran for re-election, the first time in 16 years that he faced any kind of primary challenge. Both of them, State Representative Abel Mabel Thomas and the Reverend Markel Hutchins, a 31-year-old activist, were black. This kind of loyalism and political indebtedness has stifled our communities, Hutchins said, and we're going to see next-generation civic-minded leaders rise to the occasion and heed Senator Obama's call for change. Hutchins posted his announcement to his MySpace page and attempted to link himself to Obama. But Lewis trounced all comers, winning 69% of the votes cast in the 5th District and, as is customary, drawing no Republican general election challenger. He won in part by reminding his constituents of his past glories. Some people talk about change, he said. I am change. Like many, he cried the night Obama was elected president, telling ABC News, if someone had told me in 1961 or in marching across that bridge in Selma that I would be witnessing this unbelievable transformation in American politics, I would have said, you're crazy. You're out of your mind. You don't know what you're talking about. The generational storyline and the resentment the divide created spread throughout the community with a fury that seemed to feed on itself. Spike Lee, the 51-year-old film director, was one of those whose anger spilled over into mainstream discussion. These old black politicians say, ooh, Massa Clinton was good to us. Massa hired a lot of us. Massa was good. Whoo, the filmmaker told New York Magazine. Charlie Rangel, David Dinkins, they have to understand this is a new day. People ain't feeling that stuff. It's like a tide, and the people who get in the way are just going to get swept out into the ocean. Established black politicians got the message once it became clear Obama was about to wrap up the Democratic nomination. Some of Clinton's last remaining loyal black supporters began anxiously sidling over to Obama. When the senator did a victory lap of sorts on the House floor in the spring, making a rare appearance in the opposite chamber, he received big hugs from Representatives Gregory Meeks and Alcee Hastings, who had spurned his advances earlier in the year, and Representative Yvette Clark of New York rushed to get him to autograph a copy of that day's New York Daily News. Its headline, "It's His Party."
And that will do it for the second audio session. We'll pick up there next week. We're in Chapter 2, Context of White Supremacy. If you would like to participate, number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. I am reading the Kindle version this time. I do enjoy reading Kindle versions just to see, because as you read, you can see what other people who have the Kindle have highlighted as you read. And that's always interesting. Generally, people do not highlight the same things that I highlight. Thus far, I've not seen any interesting highlights, but I will share observations if anything stands out as we read. The caller at 3637, Roz, and the caller at 7722. You're all with us. I see other hands. I will add them. Please don't wait till the last minute. We have at least a half hour. Feel free to share any thoughts or observations.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Gus, I was able to get a couple of things here that I wanted to touch on. And the first thing was, earlier in the reading, she said that Bill Cosby, Denzel Washington, and there was another, famous black male that she had named, were able to circumvent white guilt. And I wonder what that means. How do you circumvent something that doesn't exist? White people are not guilty, don't feel guilty about anything. The only thing that they ever show any emotion about is when they get caught and exposed for what they do in a public forum. Outside of that, there's no such thing as white guilt. And how did they straddle it? Ultimately, when I actually looked in hindsight, I could say, how could Bill Cosby have straddled white guilt? Circumvent white guilt. And now he's sitting there almost pushing 80 years old, and they're trying to bury him under the jail for, crimes that were supposedly committed, 40 years ago. So that was just interesting. The other one, at one point she said that there were black people that were able to straddle the racial divide. And I don't understand that either. How do you straddle? And again, that alludes to the use of metaphors. How do you straddle a racial divide when there's only one race, and that's the white race? Again, alluding to her confusion as a victim of white supremacy. So those terms really kind of threw me off. Also, when she said at one point in the text that whites feel comfortable with blacks that don't carry that rage, and I'm thinking she's assuming to the rage that some black people might have in reference to being abused and victims of white supremacy. So again, when I talked about earlier how this can be confusing for the average black person, because that's kind of like a subtle prodding, telling black people forget what happened to you, and white people will be comfortable with you as long as you never address what has been done to you, you never speak about any of the abuse that you have suffered and that you continue to suffer, and as long as you go along with the white people's practice of rhetorical ethics by making us think that they're making changes by doing these cosmetic things. And I see the election of President Obama as a cosmetic change, just like the entire civil rights movement was cosmetic. And now everything that all the so-called gains that black people have made during that time period have all been rolled back. So to me, that just really stands out, because it's alluding to, and again, it kind of alludes to the fact that I think the book was written for non-white people. And then she said some things about Andrew Young that I found to be fascinating. Andrew Young said that Martin Luther King would still be alive if he hadn't accomplished so much so soon. And to me, this is the
a nice example of the confusion of putting blacks that are showcased in public forums that really shouldn't be speaking publicly whatsoever, simply because for him to allude to that is basically saying, again, black people should not work hard to accomplish anything, and any sort of accomplishment, in my opinion, in the system of white supremacy, whatever that may mean, would be too much too soon, because black people aren't supposed to have anything in the system of white supremacy, and anything that we do have, we're supposed to ask for it, beg for it, and plead for it to, you know, the almighty white people to for them to bestow it upon us. So just the whole idea that Reverend Andrew Young would say that he accomplished too much too soon, and that's why he's dead. In other words, he was fighting white supremacy, and that's why he was dead. It had nothing to do with him accomplishing anything, simply because towards the end of his own life, he spoke out about the fact that he felt that the civil rights movement was a sinking ship, that he had helped black people basically board that ship. And then he also said something else. He quoted something else he said when they were talking about the election of President Obama and his caution at, I guess, feeling optimism about his election. He said that he still has scars from Egypt and the wilderness, which, again, he's basically alluding to the false premise that Jewish people were enslaved by black people from Egypt, and that he was one of those people, and that he still has scars from that quote-unquote Egyptian experience and from the wilderness. So this is just a ball of confusion in regards to the black people who are being showcased. And it's still happening to this day, where we have these so-called leaders that are paraded in front of us on the television or in any other medium that white supremacists use to try and confuse and totally distort black people's view of how to fight this system and their understanding of the system and how it works. And a lot of what's being talked about is alluding to black people getting so-called ahead in this system by doing everything that white people have been basically training us to do for the last 500 years, not discuss our racism, white supremacy, not fighting racism, white supremacy, take so-called slowing down and not trying to do anything about it in an immediate manner, which it needs to be handled immediately. So everything that white people have been doing and training us to do is what some of the black people are actually alluding to here. And that's the danger of just having black people who don't understand the system of white supremacy and giving them a microphone or a TV, or putting them on TV for them to speak to millions and millions and millions of confused black people. And that further obfuscates reality for us and helps the system of white supremacy by doing so. Thank you. And I'll meet my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. The caller at 7722, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, the same as the last caller, the note about Bill Cosby immediately stuck out to me now, just looking back and saying how white people felt comfortable with him. Just looking back, I don't think that I would have seen Bill Cosby to be in the position he was in today, but it was just interesting. It stuck out to me. The second thing was when she was referring to retired General Colin Powell, and how he did not feel safe to run in 95. And I can remember clearly before President Obama ran, there was a feeling that no black man could run for president because he would immediately be killed. And that was unfortunately a very stark reality for me and a lot of people, other non-whites that I knew at that time. But to hear him say, or to say, Gwen Ifill say that he was speaking of it not being safe and his wife thinking that and discouraging him from running because not feeling it was safe just really presents the system of white supremacy as drawing clear lines, even for somebody who was quote unquote as accomplished as Colin Powell, a victim of racism, white supremacy. And the last thing that I noticed was John Lewis when she was speaking about him, and he was saying, talking about not wanting to be, I believe it was John Lewis who was saying he didn't want to be on the wrong side of history. I've normally heard that phrase used by white people to describe, usually it generally deals with racism when I hear white people use that phrase saying how decisions that are made and people were on the quote unquote wrong side of history or don't want to be on the quote unquote wrong side of history. White people have never been on the wrong side of history because we just see historically they have always shown to advance via the domination and terrorism of other non-white people. So it's one of those phrases which, when I heard it, it just made me reflect on how I could probably, I don't have any use for that phrase anymore, because it's always seemed to be used as a justification for moving either one way or the other. But white people have always been on the right side of history via their domination and terrorism. I'll take my call offline. Thank you.
Appreciate that. I've been hearing that phrase of late. I've been hearing it used a lot with the anti-sex LGBT issues. I've heard people saying they didn't want to be like on the wrong side of history on HB2, the bathroom bill down in North Carolina, and things like that. The caller, retired firefighter, did you have a commentary you wanted to share, sir?
Yes. Greetings, everyone. I haven't heard a lot because I'm trying to be up here in Orlando, as I stated that I was going to be, and at the same time, just was able to tune in a little bit. But I kind of get an idea of how this book read is going, because I hear it a lot on some of the other radio programs that are popular. I think it's Urban Radio, I think it's called. And basically what it is a lot of non-white black people have basically been deceived on the what actually is the concept, as Mr. Fuller says, of America, Africa, and Asia. But it's actually not a reality, but a lot of us actually think it's a reality, because we hear white people talking about it all of the time in this part of the world. And so we find ourselves, some of us find ourselves putting a lot of our efforts to part of the title of the book, I believe it's called Breakthrough to this imaginary feeling of being collateral or lateral with white people, in a sense, you know, with this idea, and it's something that we just keep going, doing over and over and over again. Now, I understand that America is a concept that nobody is practicing. Actually, what we're under is a global system of racism, white supremacy. That is the confusion that I think that have been infecting non-white black people, who otherwise, with their level of study and what I would call some level of self-respect, would be actually be putting their time towards the reality. They actually are kind of like chasing a very shrewd, deceptive reality that white people have most of us under, as far as my understanding from a logical standpoint is, and I'm hearing this in this reading, is what I'm saying. I didn't know too much about the subject of the book, but the only thing I've heard a lot is of how much self-respect that she had, and how she was a very professional person. And there's certainly a lot of non-white black people who follow in that way, but I think they are under, they're confused to the standpoint, they may be confused to the standpoint to, whereas they think the concept of America is actually a reality. They think it's actually a reality, so therefore the idea is to keep fighting this so I can gain some kind of equal status, you know, as opposed to understanding the global system of race and white supremacy. Those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Appreciate that. 1842, did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everyone. A few things that I was thinking about listening to everyone's commentary earlier and listening to her read her book. Number one, I'm happy that she read it. I was actually really happy when I realized that she was reading her own work. I also have to admit that I am not that knowledgeable when it comes to politics and who did what, when, and so the book has been very informative for me up until this point, just because I'm not really set politically savvy. I was like, oh, I didn't even know that had happened, or there's so many names, I was like, I don't even know who that is. So that's been good. One thing that, there are a few other things, but this one thing I thought was really peculiar, how the Republican Party wanted Colin Powell to run. I did not know that. I didn't even know Colin Powell was considered for president, or that, I didn't even know that was a conversation, to be honest. And then I thought to myself, the Republican Party is supposed to be really conservative, unless I'm confused, and this is like before they made a switch back in the, like, so why do they want this black man to run for president? And so that must have been something that white people together must have decided that they wanted to put a black man in office. This is what I'm thinking. And it could be for many reasons. Maybe it was just time to show the world that they could, like maybe work that they did in South Africa, or, you know, like their opposition to apartheid or whatever. Maybe they had to show that they were different or something like that. But the fact that they wanted to put Colin Powell just kind of stuck out to me and made me think again about how white people plan really, really, really far in advance. And I think the name, it might be Alec, but please forgive me if I'm mistaken, where politicians and corporations have like a secret relationship and they meet together and stuff. I almost want to say there has to be one with the so-called Republicans and the so-called Democrats, where they just like leave their red and blue, colors at the door, and they're just white, and they determine what they're going to do, how they might do it, which party might. And since Colin, like, I'm pretty sure white people did not expect for Colin Powell to be like, no. They might have assumed that he was really ambitious and wasn't going to listen to his wife, even if his wife said no, and that he would go and do it. And so we would have had this black president in Colin Powell and not Obama. But for me, it's kind of like, well, white people wanted him. Like, that was, if I didn't have any proof before that white people really just wanted a black person in office as president, that kind of confirmed it for me. So, and then another thing, I'm glad that you all pointed out, there was a couple of points where I was like, my face was a little twisted in listening to some of the things that she was saying, but I kind of checked myself and I was like, well, maybe I'm just being really hard on her because she's non-white. And maybe I don't like her voice or something like that. And I brushed it off like, no, this has to be super constructive and all these other things. And but then in listening to the first part of the commentary, I was like, well, this must be, you know, what it means to just be logical despite whether the person is white or non-white. And I'll also share that I never knew anything about Glenn Ifill until she passed, and we were talking about it here. I didn't even know what she looked like. So it's not like I had any affinity or connection or anything, like, just did not know who she was. So that was another reason I kind of wanted to read the book too. Just, you know, I'm tired of missing the bus. It's what it feels like sometimes. But with that, some of the things when she was talking, and I was like, well, don't be harsh, don't be judgmental and criticizing, and just, you know, be open to the work. So I was like, what did she just say? But she was a little confusing for me too, just as someone who's still confused about a lot of things. If I had like listened to her without having anybody else's, without being able to listen to the logical critique or the assertions of different opinions, I would have taken some of that stuff like, oh, okay, sure. Okay, sure. Especially because I, like I said before, I'm not that politically savvy. And I just would have taken it as this, she's right. I mean, she's black, she's saying it, you know, everyone loved her. Not to say that that's like a measurement for whether or not you're doing something right, but I mean, hopefully you all understand what I'm saying. But breaking down some of that, and then after that, I was like, oh my gosh, she is using a ton of metaphors. Like, what is this sandpaper thing? Which I still don't understand. So I will ask, if someone could help me understand, what does she mean when she's talking about the sandpaper? I'm still confused. But that's what I have to share for this evening. Thank you.
Anybody figures out that sandpaper thing, ditto for Gus T, because I have no idea what that means either. And since I have the Kindle, I can do cool things like get immediate word counts. For me, it is highly suspicious and significant. The word sandpaper is in this book 12 times. Racism is in the book 11 times. I did not think we were talking about carpentry. Other things that stood out, she is continuing to use the metaphor of these black breakthroughers, President Obama and Cory Booker, and that is like bang, bang, double cowbell, which is hugely important that two of the main breakthrough people she mentions both have white mothers. At any rate, when she's talking about these people and saying that they are able to straddle the racial divide, which is a term that is highly incorrect, which I strongly discourage people from using, when she's saying that these black people are straddling the racial divide, she's mostly talking about, and it might be, she has been, I think, almost except for one exception, I think when she was talking about Donna Brazile, who just had her kerfuffle as well. But with the exception of Donna Brazile, every time she's talking about a black person straddling the racial divide, it's a black male straddling. It gives me, like, thinking of someone being on a bicycle, or riding a horse, where it's kind of bringing the focal point to the genital area, which kind of reminded me of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing again, particularly since most of the people that she's talking about are doing the straddling are black males, bringing it to as Dr. Welsing says, keep your eye on the ball game. The other things that stood out in this portion of the text. Let's see. I was thinking, this book is not going to age well, which might be part of the logic, the reasoning in terms of the commentary that I've had and some of the other listeners. The comments about Bill Cosby, egad. White people maybe are not so comfortable with good old Bill. After all, I don't know if he'll be doing any jello pudding selling. In fact, I was thinking, because I said when I was commenting after the first audio segment that portions of the book, you know, I think it would be accurate to say that they are recklessly inaccurate. And I was thinking, like, well, you know, is that a reasonable assessment? You know, are you exaggerating? Do you think that's truth? Does the evidence support that? And when she hit that passage where she said, perhaps African-Americans have already reached a turning point, at least in theory, after all, Bill Cosby can sell Jell-O, Oprah Winfrey can sell books, and Michael Jordan can sell Hanes underwear, Denzel Washington outranks Tom Hanks as America's favorite movie star, why shouldn't black politicians be equally acceptable to the majority? That, to me, just seems like gross in comparing black entertainers, comedians, athletes to someone who is in position to make laws that govern how people are going to function on a local or national level. I mean, that is absurd. I would not accept anyone making a comparison saying, well, hey, white people, they love to go and watch, you know, LeBron James and Serena Williams, so of course they'll have no problem with black people. Like, I would look at anybody like, are you insane? Much less someone who's supposed to be really informed about these issues. Where she continues, where she says, she continues online. How could race still be a problem in America if white people could now identify with black entertainers and athletes if Bill Cosby was welcome in their homes? He is most surely not. No less a political figure than Republican Karl Rove made just such a point during Fox News election night coverage in 2008. I think whites are very good at promoting that sort of lie. And what made it even more funny for me is that I think almost all of the people that she mentioned have had many different incidents of racism that they've talked about, even after they have become big stars and made all this money and everything, where racism has still been a big problem. I know that's been the case for Oprah Winfrey, and Denzel Washington was talking about an incident where I think he was in Boston. I might even have to go dig and find it, where he said that he was accosted. I think some white person didn't recognize him, so he was just another Negro on the street and said something nasty to him. And I think his wife might have even been mistreated as well in all of this. But anyway, anyway, confusion is lethal. Some of the other things that stood out, straddle the racial divide, I brought that up already. Something kind of strikes me, like I pointed out the cartoon that she was praising, the Saturday Night Live sketch about President Obama distancing himself. Stiff arm is the word she used, from Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. The tone I get from the book, even though it seems she interviewed Al Sharpton and includes some of his commentary in the book, it seems like there is like contempt or getting some jabs in at Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton along the way. I definitely got that impression during the audio segment I played at the beginning, and it seems to continue in the book, just the kind of tone and manner in which she talks about both of these people. It kind of reminds me of the way that I often hear whites talk about these people, with kind of an implied disdain. Like, these are just two of the most despicable folks ever, and it'd be better if they just left and we never had to hear from them again. That'll be something to pay attention to, tone towards Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. And also, her starting this book, I can appreciate, you know, generational differences, right, in terms of how younger black people feel about racism or President Obama or politics in general. That came up with this election as well. And the same type of thing where they were saying many older black people had a greater affinity for the Clintons than did many younger black people, who were more critical of her for things she and her Hillary Clinton and her husband had done. I get that. That's totally valid, totally reasonable. But something just seemed... like what she has sentences in the book where it suggests that the greatest obstacle that President Obama faced was from other black people. Like that, and I mean, particularly now, again, as we sit at the end, that just seems absurd. That seems absurd for then. It seems absurd now. Like, I wouldn't care what Andrew Young or Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton or any other black person had to say about President Obama or anything, really, in terms of, we start talking about who has power, the ability to decide, well, we're in charge of your security, and maybe we'll stop that armed person from hopping over the fence, and maybe we won't. That type of power, I don't think it's even, that's what I mean when I say some of these things just seem like recklessly inaccurate. Like, some, even, you know, some racists should have been like, wait a minute now, maybe we shouldn't put that in. I mean, that's, they're niggers. If this book is intended for black people, if we expect the niggers to read it, they're dumb. But I mean, you know, let's not go overboard just saying any old thing down on the page here. And just to make sure that I make sure I read that quote so that people don't think that I am making things up. I thought 1842's point, her dissection of some more recent political history, Colin Powell being looked at seriously for president, which he certainly was. He talks about that in his biography, autobiography. The portion, yeah, it just seems like it's a lot of focused on black people in conflict with each other. I resoundingly reject the notion that this is airing our dirty laundry, I think is the way that she phrased it in the book. I take the position that whites, number one, are not ignorant about black people. They're not ignorant about racism. And two, it seems that anytime black people and non-black people have any sort of conflict or what have you, it becomes a big to-do anyway, a real, real public affair. Sometimes that seems to be a big part of it, to do all this for the audience, brawling and being in conflict with another black person. So I do not reject that. I reject that notion that there's some sort of effort to conceal conflict between black people, at least to conceal this. So it's happening behind closed doors. And I also, just something struck me, like that's how we're starting this book. This assessment of this historical breakthrough is black people squabbling and bickering with each other. Like, that is something, just strikes me as very typical, and not a constructive way about how frequently we are encouraged to look at racism along with a lot of metaphors and rhetoric. the metaphors just piled up continually. She says, when there are only so many ladders available to climb, the struggle to maintain one's hold on any one rung can become intense. Al Sharpton's described as a political lightning rod playing the presidential, played the 2008 presidential race card. That's what I mean when I say, when I read the way she talks about Al Sharpton and the way that she talks about Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, frequently there seems to be the suggestion of contempt, the typical type of disdain that I hear from whites when they mention these two individuals. Let's see. Harold Ford Jr., she mentions as one of these breakthroughers. He lost his U.S. Senate race in 2006. Mr. Ford, they ran a political ad against him where it suggested that he was taking funds to solicit prostitutes. And in the campaign ad that they ran against him, they had a what looked like they were putting it in your mind that this was a white call girl, as they might say, or a prostitute, but a white prostitute that was telling Harold to call her, calling him by his first name, saying, "Harold, call me," as though they had already hooked up sexually. That was, I think, a part of the ad campaign that resulted in him losing his seat. I think that, and that got a lot of attention, national attention. People talked about that specific ad with Mr. Harold Ford Jr. A little surprised she didn't include that in the text as well. Let's see. Again, lots of metaphors for the way that we are talking about and understanding this issue. I thought it was interesting where she talks about Colin Powell, who does in his autobiography talk about the Army as being less racist or less having less discrimination, put that in quotes. I just think that there are other black veterans of that period who had a different perspective, a dramatically different perspective. Mark Essex being one. He was a member of the Black Panther Party, and he led a counterviolent attack on the New Orleans Police Department. I think he killed at least five officers. He was in the armed services, and he talked about the racism he experienced as a member of the armed services, being a part of what led him to join the Black Panther Party and to engage in counterviolence. Again, lots of metaphors, lots of metaphors. Let's see. I was just trying to make sure I found the portion where she was, in my view, suggesting that President Obama was having more difficulties with other black people. Yes, here it is. So she says, few of these successful black politicians claim to have pulled off success on their own, the breakthroughers, but those who marched back then often turn out to be the biggest critics of those who are poised to take over now. I just, particularly now with Donald Trump, the birthers, the Tea Partiers, and everything that has happened over the last 8 years, and even everything that happened during 2008, is that accurate? I mean, we don't have to be about, you know, how we feel. Is that a truthful statement? The biggest critics of President Obama, since he's one of the breakthroughers that we're talking about, the biggest critics of President Obama have been older black politicians, older black people, civil rights figures and what have you. Is that true? Yes, I remember I've heard Cornel West over the last 8 years and a few other folks. Absolutely. Tavis Smiley, I've heard them. Absolutely. Accurate to say, those are his biggest critics. Those have been the biggest obstacles for President Obama and other breakthroughers over the last 8 years. I mean, continuing. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? I'll check to see if anybody has any super racial identity. It was difficult to get through. And again, I can only say I just don't think this book is going to age well. I think this is a book, I suspect, if people look back at this book 10, 20 years later, it does have a lot of great detail. She certainly did her homework, but in terms of an accurate assessment of the power dynamics of racism, white supremacy, it is not going to age well. And particularly with Trump, Bill Cosby, man. Anything I want to make sure I get in before? The portion where she said she was talking about Bill Clinton and I guess the struggle over who was going to vote. And that was a big to-do in 2008, certainly not to downplay that. But she says it's not a matter of being inexperienced when she's talking about some of the people who felt that Andrew Young being one who felt President Obama was too young. It is a matter of being young. Young said he was supporting Hillary Clinton essentially because of Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton, he said, is every bit as black as Barack Obama. This, he said, was because he'd once seen Bill Clinton do a Michael Jackson moonwalk. An image of it is hard to conjure. That was painful, not in a critique of the book part. It was certainly great that she was able to include that. But again, it just, in my view, it shows the monumental confusion. I'm reminded, I think when we had Paul Ifeanyi Grant on the program from the UK, and he said emphatically that he rejected the notion that, you know, the majority or even a sizable chunk of black people are confused about what racism is and how it works. That came to mind when I read this paragraph about Bill Clinton moonwalking and being every bit as black as President Obama. I think I can conclude there. I did highlight a lot more, but it would basically kind of just be all in the same vein of what I have shared thus far. Yes, I will stop there. I thought Donald Brazile's metaphor was the best one in the book that we've heard thus far about being beholden to the Clinton, to Master and Mrs. Clinton, and wanting off of that plantation. Great, best line in the book we've read thus far. Anybody have anything they wanted to get in before we conclude?
Gus, I wanted to ask, what was the sandpaper metaphor again?
She says it's sandpaper conflict, but she never explains what that means specifically. She just describes this moment of President Obama winning the election as being sandpaper conflict. Sometimes she uses it to describe when black people disagreed with one another about whether they were going to support President Obama or Hillary Clinton. She referenced that generational difference as being sandpaper conflict. She's used it in a variety of different ways and contexts thus far in the book. But she, at least in my view, unless I missed it, there's not a paragraph where she explains, like, this is exactly what I mean by sandpaper conflict. That's why I think 1842 and myself are looking for help.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting metaphor. It's confusing to me, too. The only thing that makes sense to me, at least logically, is that it's alluding to a heavy friction, because that's what sandpaper does. It's using friction to remove rough parts of wood. So the only thing I could think of, logically speaking, other than outside of that context, it makes no sense to me either, is that it's something that involves heavy friction between, I guess, the two opposing parties. Outside of that context, it really is. I wish she was here to explain that, because it is confusing. And I just wanted to touch on something you brought up earlier. You were talking about the term the wrong side of history, and you were speaking of how today it's being used in context to the I think it's the H2 law in regards to the anti-sexual bathrooms and the LGBT movement. And to me, that the context in which it's used today is very similar to just the overall attempt to attach anti-sexuality to black people. Same thing would go to the Orange is the New Black show, or all of the different ways in which they're trying to connect anti-sexual behavior in the LGBT community and their supposed struggle for whatever deviant freedoms that they're looking for, and attaching that to the black struggle for liberation, or at least connecting the two, or making it seem like if they're similar or symbiotic in some way. So I thought that was a great assessment that you had made earlier. Thank you, and I'll meet my line.
Appreciate that. They just tried to blame Donna Brazile. They had that after the election. They tried to blame it on her. I remember that some white woman yelled at her because I think she got in trouble for, they alleged she leaked, I guess, some of the questions to Hillary Clinton for the second debate or one of the debates. And that came out, and so they got in trouble for that, being corrupt and all that, and someone tried to fuss and blame Donald Brazile for that. I also thought it was an important sentence, the John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, when he said, but Lewis made yet another leap across the generational divide after his own Atlanta district went 3-1 for Obama. During the Georgia primary, he switched to Obama, and a politician less admired, it would have been called a flip-flop. But with Lewis, the shift seemed genuinely painful. The process, he told NBC correspondent Andrea Mitchell, was more difficult than getting his head bashed in as he crossed Selma's Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965. That, I thought, was an astounding paragraph, particularly to me, because it sounded very much as though he had some sort of relationship with the Clintons. I think it said in the book, Bill Clinton just called him on the phone and said, we need you in South Carolina. And he went and got on a plane like immediately to go help them. So it sounds like he had some sort of relationship, unfortunately, emotional connection with these whites. And it seemed like that was a part of what made it difficult, feeling like he was abandoning the Clintons to support Obama. wow, that, again, the victimization. John Lewis, for sure, is a victim of racism. I don't have a criticism at all, but, I mean, that's, the damage is deep. Our victimization is immense. White girls do it better. 30 seconds, anybody got anything they need to get in 30 seconds? So are we done for the week? I will assume folks are satisfied. This, I know at least for me, this is not like going to be enjoyable, like rereading The Spook Who Sat by the Door or Medical Apartheid, but it does have information in it, and I am going to be looking to read, and it's not that long. If there's any silver lining, this is also a short book, so we will be done quickly. We'll be able to move on, and we'll do Delectable Negro next, since that was the book that tied for winning. That will wrap us up for this week, though. We're in Chapter 2. This is where we'll pick up at next Friday, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have questions, input, if we have anybody, if you are a fan of the book, if you think we have just, you know, missed it, we misinterpreted it, and we have not given a reasonable interpretation, an accurate interpretation of Miss Eiffel's work, you can email. I'll share it on the program next week, and we should have at least three, four more sessions to go, so you should have time to even call in and rebut and, you know, give your thoughts on the work if you think we have misread or you think it is accurate in terms of how she's interpreting racism in the text. We'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Mountain, and 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll tune in. We'll catch up. It was a big week. Lots of stuff happened over the course of the past 6-7 days. The Michael Slager was found or mistrial in the shooting of Walter Scott last year. Dylan Stormroof death penalty trial began in South Carolina. His mother apparently had a heart attack in the courtroom after hearing the details of what her little race soldier did. Incredible week on the plantation. Lots of stuff happened. We'll catch up, review tomorrow, and of course the holiday madness continues, so we can share on that as well. If you have any other questions or feedback, just drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, and I will again encourage sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. It is the holiday madness. Just that alone is reason enough to stick with being sober. You do not want to be out and about if it's bad weather. It's been snowing here. And then them having checkpoints out because they know it's holiday season and what have you. I would just say you don't want to increase the likelihood of there being any additional unnecessary problems for you as a victim of racism, particularly if you're going to be out on the road. If you're going to be a driver, passenger, even a pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence of alcohol, cannabis, any other narcotics, legal or no, and behind the wheel of a vehicle. You're putting yourself in danger. You never know when it'll be Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw that is pulling you over. That could be a life-ending, life-altering moment in a matter of seconds, and that goes for a white person, badge or no, which unfortunately the last week has repeatedly shown. Just keep that in mind. War is being waged against non-white people, particularly black people at all times in all areas of people activity. Let's be sure our behavior reflects that. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.